This week's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the following advertisers.
Graveyard Slaughter would like to tell you about their upcoming Kickstarter campaign. If you're old enough, you remember the joy of wandering the blissfully bloody aisles of the horror selection at your local video rental store. Not those big, brightly lit stores like Blockbuster either. The hole-in-the-wall shops. The shops where you could find some deep-dive horror movies. Well, welcome to video hell. Lunchbox Press proudly invites you back to those video stores of old and presents Graveyard Slaughter, currently on Kickstarter. Graveyard Slaughter is a comic book anthology that's dripping with sloppy, oozy, gooey 1980s VHS gore. Over 50 terrifying pages of madness co-written by New York Times best-selling author Colin Bunn and Kevin Watkins. Art provided by legendary ghostwriter artist Javier Saltares, rising star Pumpkinhead artist Blackie Shepherd, Gary Bedall, and Adam McLaughlin. Introduction provided by Bram Stoker award-winning and best-selling author Paul Tremblay. Graveyard Slaughter will be running on Kickstarter all through June. Back the comic today and unlock all of the super rad stretch goals exclusive only to Graveyard Slaughter Kickstarter backers. Lunchbox Press proudly presents Graveyard Slaughter on Kickstarter in June. And remember, always, be kind, rewind, or die. Just head to Kickstarter.com and search for Graveyard Slaughter today.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is also sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from all around the world. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head right on over to Diabolik DVD, where you could find awesome releases from Vinegar Syndrome, including Dark Room, The Suckling, and Grandmother's House. You can also find all of the AGFA and Something Weird titles, including Ninja Zombie, Blood Lake, and Lady Street Fighter. From Garage House Pictures, both Supercock and Foes. And also all of the latest releases from Scream Factory, including The Brain, Seven, Golden Vampires, When a Stranger Calls Back, The Chosen, and Superstition. So for all of your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to DiabolikDVD.com or find them on Facebook.
Tonight's Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service, super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic, irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest growing human curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. It is the Netflix of horror, but I think it's more than that, actually. To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES. And that is Shudder, S-H-U-D-D-E-R.
This episode is also brought to you by Fangoria. In July of 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. And now, this summer, Fangoria magazine is turning 40 and celebrating accordingly with its fourth issue. 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horror's past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give away anything yet because we want you to experience it for yourself, but we can safely say that you do not want to miss a single page in issue number 4 because we're celebrating in style. Head over to Fangoria.com, that's Fangoria.com, to learn more and subscribe. And if you subscribe today, your subscription starts with the 40th anniversary issue, issue number 4, shipping in July. Use the code SHOCKWAVES to save 10% off your subscription. That's SHOCKWAVES for 10% off over at Fangoria.com. Okay, welcome to episode 150 of Shockwaves. I'm your host, Rob G. The whole team is here. Holy smokes.
Hey, Ulrich Kane. Guys.
You weren't even meant to be here today.
But they don't know that.
No one knows that.
I was doing Clerks.
Go ahead. Tell them about the airport parking situation. Yeah, that was a really riveting story.
You got off a plane and you're getting on a plane.
Yes, I've been here for about 40 hours, I think. And I just started a vacation and then had to come back. But I was away for a good thing. I got, which we'll talk about in a sec, some Snowpocalypse.
Whoa, that's Ryan Turek with the sound effects.
Wow, that's a very sporty sound effect.
That's what he's bringing into the table now.
Do you guys remember, cast your mind back to when there was a period where we had a sound effect machine?
We talked about it.
And it didn't last very long.
It did not last.
I think we broke it on the Drunken Debates episode.
I think so, too. Toilet flush again. Come on, guys.
But Ryan
never
got to play with it.
I never did.
It was pretty fun. Rebecca McKendry is here as well, by the way.
I got the air horn as well.
She was there for the sound effects episode.
I was. Sure. That was the wild one.
Yeah. That's when you said it smelled like a dorm room or something.
No, I said it smelled like a frat house.
That's it. Yes, that's correct.
And it was
it
a little worse.
That's accurate.
It was kind of accurate.
Was Mike Williamson
rancid.
There?
Yeah, he was. It was Mike Williamson, Parker. It was a bunch of guys drinking and talking about horror movies and smelling
like
it.
College.
It was fun.
So glad I missed it.
It was a pretty fun night. If we could find a way that we didn't have to drive, I would encourage it.
Yeah, because the second one wasn't nearly as
I think Shockwave's
fun.
Bus. A bus.
A Shockwave's bus.
Deliver us every episode. We get
party bus.
Trash.
Party
so what
bus.
We're looking for is somebody to give us a ride.
No, I want that party cycle. You know the thing where all the people are biking but also drinking while they do it?
We saw that while we were in...
It's a very surreal thing.
Where were we?
Phoenix.
That we saw that. No, it wasn't
Nashville.
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 We were stuck in Nashville. We kept seeing those and it was like bachelorette parties going like, girls night.
But
it was
crazy. Shockwave's version.
Well, why don't you want to pitch Shaka Khan to our audience now?
Shaka Khan, which you kept talking about in Texas Frightmare?
I think I'm saying Shaka Khan, but I'm saying Shocker because we have Ryan in the house.
Ryan Larson's here.
We started the Shockers. Shocker Con, where we would get all the people in the Shockwaves fan group or listener group, and we would all meet somewhere to do our own version of like a little Beyond Fest type thing just for a day or
two
and have a big dinner together, get to know each other, and watch some cool movies and do a live show. I think Shocker Con could be a real thing. That's my pitch for it right here.
Shaka Khan.
As opposed to William Girdler Khan 2019.
That is William Mahaffey and me are going to do Girdler Thong.
Oh, my God.
The thing is, I have a lot of thongs.
Girdler Thong. And
me and Patrick Bromley want to do Sybil Thong. So, really, there's a lot of things.
Sybil Thong is a thing.
You know what,
guys? That sounds like it'd be great.
I'm in for Shaka Khan.
Okay.
I'm not so sure about Girdler Khan. And I'll be talking about Manitou shortly.
Oh, wow. You're on point.
Yeah, I am.
Well,
Elric, we don't have you for long. Jump in. Go.
Okay. I got on a plane.
Yes.
And on that plane, I got to watch a movie. And the only reason I bring it up, not horror, it's called Little Woods. Oh. And the reason I wanted to watch this, the only reason I was curious about watching this is Nia DaCosta wrote and directed this film. And she was chosen by Jordan Peele to reboot Candyman. Yeah. So I was very interested personally to be like, who did you choose?
I want to see this movie.
It's on planes. I assume it's on VOD.
So Ryan, book a flight right now. Watch this movie.
I believe it's Tessa Thompson. It's interesting. It's cool casting because there's one of the it's two siblings, sisters, and one's black and one's white. They have the same mother, different fathers. They live in a very rural. I'm not sure where it's set, but it's a rural area with lots of construction and like kind of just it's very blue collar. Everyone's addicted to what's the thing? Everyone's addicted to
Oxy.
Oxy. It's there's a major Oxy problem. She has done some time, but not very much for dealing that stuff. Is trying to go straight. This is Tess Thompson we're talking about, and she basically needs to try to raise a little bit of money quickly to save the mortgage on a house. And it's, you know, the setup's pretty generic, but the execution is really like realistic. There's nothing in it that you would think horror, but it's very grounded. So in this modern era where we're picking, you know, people who are directing films by, you know, grounding them in reality first and then letting the supernatural fly, I think it's an interesting choice. There's a couple scenes that maybe could hint at something other than just straight drama, but I liked it. I didn't love the movie, but I could see what his eye for talent might be in it. Worth checking out. But again, that was just – I was just – really the only reason I watched it was because I was curious. But yeah, so I went to – just quickly, I'll just talk about Snowpocalypse because I had wanted to do something. So years ago, Patrick Bromley wrote an article about Killer POV when we had first started that I think really helped – get some people's new ear.
Sure.
And he's Patrick's got a podcast and website, F This Movie. So a couple years ago, I wanted to do a surprise. I wanted to fly to Chicago, surprise him, not tell anyone I was coming, and just do something. And it never happened, and I never told him. So about 6 weeks ago, or 5 weeks ago, or whatever, I started writing to his wife going, I'm not sure if I'm going to come out yet or not because work stuff's weird, but I want to come out and help me, and we'll surprise him. So and then it just happened to be Snowpocalypse was on the same weekend. So I was like, boom. So I was hiding behind a wall as he was led to a gelato popular thing after Total Recall, and I jumped out, and he looked pretty, like, what the fuck, he heard my voice, and then he didn't know what the fuck I was doing there.
I wish he thought you were a mugger and, like,
he
punched
probably
you
did.
First.
He's very chill, you know, I think Tobe Hooper when I think of Patrick, but I had a lot of fun, like, just hanging out with him and his family, and we got to see some movies together, and then I went to his house, we recorded a show with no topic, we just pushed record and had a weird conversation, it was actually really cool. But super cool because you don't get to do this kind of stuff for people very often. And I think sometimes we all need a nice surprise. And, you know,
yeah.
I could use one right now, guys. So, but the movies that we got to see at Cinepocalypse, and I wish I was there longer because it's a really cool fest. I hadn't been back in Chicago for 9 years, I realized. I used to live there. The Music Box, the best theater, one of the best in America. It's a beautiful old theater. And night one, I got to see the one I was most anticipating was The Lodge, the new film by the Goodnight Mommy directors.
Oh,
it's their follow-up. Is a movie I thought would be my favorite of the year, just based on like the Sundance press saying it's like Hereditary of the year. You know, for me, it was a little flat. It's a lot of lead up. It's atmospheric. It's got I think the setup's really interesting. Riley Keough is really good in it, as she's good in everything. But where this film kind of decides to land and stay didn't really excite me by the end. It felt a little predictable and it kind of flattens out a bit. It's really about it's really hard to, I don't want to spoil anything with this one, but it's about a kind of step, a woman who's dating a man who has kids. The man's not going to be there, and they go to this isolated lodge in the snow right before Christmas, and he has to leave, leaving a woman they don't really want to look after them with these two, one's a teen and one's a little younger, kids who have a chip on their shoulder about her. I won't say why. And then we also find out that Riley Keough's past is that she actually survived a cult massacre where everyone in the cult died except her, like a long time ago. And that's in the first, like, you know, few minutes to kind of set up what her background is. They actually discover this looking at YouTube, which is actually really cool. The setup's really interesting. And as it's going, there's certain moments where I'm like, oh, if this went full hard Supernatural, I'd be so into this movie. And it's just, you know, it's not a bad movie. I like it. It just fell a little short. It's an A24 release, I believe, Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw this at Sundance?
I saw it at Sundance, yeah.
And would you say similar?
Oh, no, it's not A24. It's Neon.
Okay, that's right. It's Neon.
Many months have passed since I saw it. I remember seeing it incredibly sleepy at midnight. I mean, like, the midnight movies are so tough. But yeah.
I saw this probably.
You weren't someone else told me that that movie was incredibly tough at midnight. I was talking with somebody today who saw it at Overlook.
Yeah, it's
like,
a tough movie at midnight.
So hard.
Yeah,
it's very evenly paced. It just keeps kind of going.
But I mean, like, it was one of those films that I had read the script in advance, so I knew some of the twists and turns. Yeah. But it was just about, I wanted to see what Veronica and Severin had done, and I think they did a very good job with it. I'm looking forward to watching it again.
Yeah.
Caffeinated and with fresh eyes.
It's really well made. It's kind of like what's the one we both loved by Yorgos, Killing a Sacred Deer. Visual style is like that, really great visual style. A lot of convex lenses and like super wide.
Yeah, but
angle.
Killing of a Sacred Deer had a certain pace and a rhythm to its a cadence to its dialogue and performances that I love.
That's different. Yeah, so it's a more surreal take.
Yeah.
But I think some people will dig this one. Sure, you want to keep going around just so I don't.
No, I only have like one. So
okay, I'll run through. So later that night at midnight, we got to see the world premiere of our friend of the show, or Joe Bigas's new movie called Bliss. Which I helped get them. The first day of the shooting was at where I work. I got them an office there, and I saw kind of the energy in which they were making this, and it was really exciting because it was the first time any of them had shot on film, including the DP.
Oh wow!
And they were all jazzed, and they had a different energy about them. I'd seen these guys around movies, and they were all so excited. And this movie, it's at first it took me a little while to get into it. It's a shot on 16. It's about a woman painter who's kind of got artist block, and then just gets fucked up all the time and kind of keeps painting. And when she's really blacked out, fucked up, interesting stuff is happening in her painting. But at a certain point, she becomes a vampire. And that's from like the start. And there's so little plot to the movie that I think it actually is Joe's best work, because it's not being – he doesn't have to worry about explaining all, like, in the mind's eye. There's a lot of plot you have to then cover. And this, it's just the last 40 minutes of this movie is like total midnight movie. Like, what you want to see at midnight is balls to the wall, nudity, blood, brilliant editing. Josh Ethier, sound design and editing really goes all the way with this movie. And I feel like it's the most pure kind of thing they've made. It feels like a punk midnight movie. So I kind of could understand why they then got the Fango gig.
VFW.
Yeah, it makes sense with the energy that this movie ends with. I'm like, oh, I see that. Maybe some similarities to Devil's Candy and art and music thing. But I really liked where it went, and the performance is really good. And then the next night, this is very important to those people. We got to see Chelsea Stardust's Satanic Panic, which is a total midnight crowd pleaser in the same way. Because both of these are midnight, so you have to stay awake. It's a horror comedy. It's like perfect. Like I'm age-wise not the demographic, even though I had a lot of fun. It's definitely aimed at – if this was like Teenage Girl Slumber Party, that's going to – like 80s throwback style, it's going to kill. I think with a certain demographic, this movie is like going to be a home run. And I think you could just sense that from the crowd because, you know, it was getting laughs. Really, really good first-time lead performance. AJ Bowen, though, for me, kind of steals it because he hasn't ever gotten to do this before that I've seen. Uh-huh. He is goofy, sleazy comedy, almost like a Napoleon Dynamite type character with a sleazy mustache.
Very, very Kevin Smithy.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he works at a pizza place and he's always going, but you know, you like me. And the girl's way younger. And it's just every scene he's in was really funny. But everyone's really good. But the guy, what's the guy who's married to Rebecca Romijn?
Jerry O'Connell.
Jerry O'Connell's. Fuck, he's got like, you know, one really long scene and he's great. Like, it's a really funny scene, but it goes really far. It pushes things really up. What's so cool about it is that if you see the fact that she had those two films, it's a
totally different
opposite.
Right?
That's like the other one's more my kind, but you would know that just by knowing my taste.
Yeah.
But they're equally well done, if you know what I mean.
That's cool.
So in other words, the other one's probably going to meet more people's taste because a lot of people love horror comedies and they're starved of good horror comedies. But it's really goofy and wacky and has a lot of cool practical effects. I think, again, great midnight movie, great festival movie too. I think it's, you know, I think people are going to have a lot of fun.
Didn't RLJ pick it up for release later this year?
Yes, they did. RLJ does most of Fangoria titles.
She actually, this is a good reason to pitch it. She said, please support it because it comes out the same day as It 2.
Oh.
And she said, so please go home after It 2 and watch it on VFD. So that's going to be a rough time slot to fill, but it's probably couldn't be more different. So, and then I'll come back to one that me and Becca both saw later. Yeah. But Cinepocalypse is really cool. I'd never been. And I think now they were trying to get us out last year. And I don't know if I totally knew that. So Patrick was explaining. So I said, maybe next year we can try to get this together. Because literally probably 6 or 7 people stopped me. Like when I was with Patrick. Huge fans of the show. One person was shaking with excitement to thank me for Possession. I was like, this is what we live for, guys. It's the best.
I shake around Elric too, but for a totally different reason. It's because I'm usually drunk.
Wow. I haven't seen you drink forever.
Everyone got quiet. I had to
fill in the void.
I thought a sexual movie. Excitement.
Ryan, you go.
Okay.
I
got stacks.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I've got stuff.
But save our one for last.
Okay. I'll save it for last.
Because you're dressed for it.
Turk's on with the sound effects.
I see no whammies.
Sound effects. No whammy.
Yeah. Thank you, Rob. You got that one.
Of course I did.
All right, Becca, go ahead. I'll pull it back.
Okay. I knew you watched this one, Elric. Oh. Amityville 1982, It's All About Time.
I thanked you profusely. Because it actually was fun. But tell us your take.
Are we going to bring this back? Are we going to taint Shockwaves with another?
I'll just say, because I started watching it and then I get a text from Elric that's like, I don't know, I just saw your Instagram, I'm in. And I was like, okay, cool, it's on Amazon Prime. So this is Amityville from 1982. It's About Time. And this is after the Amityville stopped focusing on the house and started focusing on cursed objects that had been taken from the house. Like there's a doll one, and this one is about the clock. This is a surprisingly fun movie. Don't call it tainting the podcast, right?
By your favorite director
of all time. It is surprisingly fun. It's Tony Randall who did Ticks.
A whole lot of ear pollution right now.
No, it is a surprisingly fun movie. Like there's parts of it that are campy and you know, they know they're campy and they really play with it. But then at the same time, there is some genuinely like freaky stuff going on. And it's trippy. It plays a lot with time. It does not feel like an Amityville movie in any way. It just feels like a little lost, you know, kind of early 90s classic about a haunted clock.
Did you catch the Beyond reference with the woman and the dog staring at him? And
I didn't even know. But now that you've mentioned that, now I'm there.
So you're saying there's no point throughout the viewing experience, you said, it's about time to turn this off.
No.
No, you have to wait till the very last line.
They drop that line. They do. They drop that line like a hammer in the middle of it where she's just like, it's about time.
You need to watch the lamp one because we've already done this one. Now you need to hit the lamp one.
I need to see the lamp one. But I got to say, like, and once I started posting about this, I got a lot of people responding with surprisingly fun. So I encourage you to watch it, Turek.
I think it's probably the second best of the series.
Yeah, it's. I do have to say, it's actually a fun movie. Brennan's seen it. He says it's a fun movie. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well,
you do. Okay, I'm in for the lamp one next.
In the time that Elric talked about this fine film and the time that you talked about this fine film, they announced another Amityville movie.
Oh, wow.
Well, remember, last week. This has nothing to do with the house. Like, the house comes
still
up.
Still bears that name.
But you can tell it's like a marketing thing because it comes up at the beginning. Dad walks in with the clock and he says, I found this at an estate sale in Long Island, and that is like the end of it right there.
Wait, isn't the next Conjuring also going to do that story?
No.
No, they already they skipped over.
Didn't you see, Conjuring, Conjuring 2?
I did. I thought they were going to go back and show that whole movie for some reason. Why did I do that?
No. The next film, in case you guys want to know, the next film, in case you guys want to know, is called Amityville 1974.
And I assume this one is, prequel.
Two. The Amityville Horror.
That's exactly what we need right
now. Hey, guys, I think we should just make an Amityville movie like right now.
I'm going to do Amityville Doghouse.
Oh, so hey. It's all set.
And that's going to be fucking amazing. It's going to be
garden
come on,
shed.
You're into it. You're into it. All right. I want to talk about a couple things, but I'll work backwards. This was the most recent thing I saw. Goosebumps 2 Haunted Halloween.
Mm-hmm. I watched it on Netflix as well.
I did,
it
too.
It is now available on Netflix. There was a reason why I missed it when it came out last October. And I think it was because I watched the trailer and I said, it doesn't look like the charm is there. I watched it on Netflix and confirmed the charm's not there. Unfortunately, it's pretty much a kind of regurgitated Goosebumps story. Mm-hmm. Bunch of kids find a book. They open up the book. Slappy comes out. Slappy uses some Tesla machine that's in this town to unleash to send electricity out into the town and possess all of the Halloween goodies that are on display, and everything comes to life. And suddenly the town is running amok with ghosts and goblins. And then in the midst of it, you've got a series of teenagers. You've got a teenage girl who's looking to get out of town after high school. You've got Elric Kane taking selfies next to me.
He's live.
He's going live. Great.
Goosebumps live.
Goosebumps live. And then you've got the kid from It and his best friend, and they're all trying to save their town while Slappy runs amok. And, you know, the kind of monsters were really cool. The witches were great. I mean, like, I like the ingenuity of bringing all of these Halloween decorations to life. Mm-hmm. But it was just a hollow, kind of vapid experience. They kind of went through the same. Elric, I am going to knock you out.
He's just he's being very artsy about it.
He's being very artsy about it.
I'm going to disagree with you, Ryan.
Really?
I actually. Why? Well, because, all right, so I did not grow up a Goosebumps kid.
Well, back up. Did you like the first Goosebumps movie?
Loved it.
I liked it too.
It had like glaring CG problems, but it was a lot of fun though.
Which again, bad CG is extremely forgivable in 3D because mm-hmm. the 3D on the first one is amazing. No, I'm not exaggerating. Yeah. It's a really good 3D release. And also it's like, I just love Halloween-y stuff.
Sure.
Anything that fits that Halloween-y kid vibe to it. And so I didn't know anything about the second mm-hmm. one other than like, oh, did they try to remake it or what's the story with it? And so when I watched, I was trying to get a 3D version, but it doesn't exist anymore. And so I watched it on Netflix with zero expectation and it just exceeded it. Mm. And not only that, the connection to part one actually made me very excited mm-hmm. because I'm like, oh, it is a sequel. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
I know it's kind of a funny, it doesn't really add anything to it, but I just
there is no added value.
I didn't have as fun with it. The first one I saw in the theater, I actually saw it at the 99 Cent Theater in North Hollywood behind the strip club that's near the Sears. Great place, but it was
Goosebumps.
Goosebumps, and yeah, it was at the 99 Cent Theater.
What are we
and,
doing?
And I saw it with Marty, and we
wait,
both
wait, went to the strip club with Marty.
No, it's the theater behind the strip club. It's North Hollywood.
But that's the headline.
But yeah, and it was so much fun, and then we watched the second one on Netflix, and even like 6-year-old Mara was like, this isn't as fun. But what I recommend instead is House with the Clock in Its Walls is fucking awesome.
I'm waiting for that to
that's
be on
really
HBO
good.
Or Netflix.
And I swear, knowing that it's helmed by Eli Roth, I swear he pulled from Texas Chainsaw Massacre in the opening scene, like some of the shots
and
the way
that
it's set up.
Too?
Yep. So yeah, it's good.
Yeah, I just felt like, you know, listen, you had fun with it. Awesome. I just wanted more than the usual kind of like Hallmark Halloween special with a significantly larger budget. Like I wanted to like those kids. And yeah. I thought the kids just kind of
Flat. Okay. They didn't capture the there's a certain energy in the first one in terms of like the dialogue and the characters and stuff. That match. Could you please stop that, Elric? It's really distracting. There's like multiple Facebook Live. We're trying to do a podcast here, goddammit.
It was totally worth it just to get Ernie sleeping.
But anyway, Ryan, yeah. Since we were the only adults having a conversation here, apparently.
I'm about goosebumps too.
Here's
this very serious kids movie.
Here's my dream. My dream is always Sony gives us a call and says, hey, why don't you guys take our Goosebumps?
You're dropping this here right now, waiting for a Sony exec to listen.
I would love
Jesus Christ, Ryan. Is there anything you haven't remade yet?
Remade? I didn't say anything about remade.
You just continue doing it.
You wanted to do a scary Goosebumps.
And I have to say, there is so much rich material within the Goosebumps franchise, like just within the books alone, that it makes me sad that they're using some of this, that they're kind of doing their own thing, like because it's so much rich material. Like Slappy was definitely the main icon.
Well, let me ask you something as a non-Goosebumps fan.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know there's a lot of stories and books and all that, but didn't they kind of use it all in the first one? Because that's what I thought was brilliant It was like they literally
four or five. And some of them were not even from the books. Like some of them were not books I remember. And then some of them, like the gnomes, they used the quintessential ones. Like if you're looking at X-Files and going, you know, what are the top three monsters of the entire X-Files franchise? Those are the ones that they used. So it was the ones that everybody knew about, whether they'd been like a diehard fan or not.
I actually like your pitch for the X-Files movie now.
I know, right?
Should be the three best
right,
monsters.
Right, make a phone call. Let's get that. I want Fluke Man. If I don't get Fluke Man, I'm out.
Yeah. Hey, Fox. I mean, Disney. And the other thing, too, is like I'm not of the generation of Goosebumps. I'm kind of like just coasting along on that because I'm a little bit older. And I don't understand why Goosebumps really hinges on Slappy. Yeah. Slappy is so uninteresting to me as a character.
Yeah, he and the gnomes were just definitely the most popular ones. And it missed me a little bit too. I was in college by the time that Goosebumps was like really in its heyday, but I was working working in schools with a lot of theater kids. So I was reading the Goosebumps just because they'd walk in and be like, you like scary stuff here, and hand me the gnome book. And then I'm like, well, this will take me a half an hour to read. And I'd read it. And I always watched the show, even though I was in college. I'd put it on as soon as I got home from classes. So I kept up with the show the entire way through. That and Eek the Cat I watched religiously through college. So
Eek the Cat
is
that,
awesome.
I've got something to say.
Did you have these queued up? By the way, that's the second Savage Steve Holland reference today.
You're
Eek
right.
The Cat. And the pressure luck whammy.
Savage Steve Holland. Yeah. He gave me one of the cartoons. I got one of the cells from Eek the Cat.
Well, that is
$2. He did sign you $2, actually.
That's amazing.
Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween. Not a recommend.
Who would have thought that would have been such a big combo?
Rob,
so there you go.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump in.
I like the first one.
Rob, you got something?
I saw one thing, and you talked about it a couple of weeks ago. I watched Leprechaun Returns because did that premiere on Sci-Fi? I can't remember what
that was. The one from this year?
Yeah.
The new one?
The newest.
Well, it was like a day and date.
Okay. But I pre-ordered the Blu-ray and completely forgot that I pre-ordered the Blu-ray. So it was one of those things where, because it premiered on Sci-Fi and maybe VOD.
Yeah, it was
but
on,
the Blu-ray was like a month later. And
it
was like $10. I was like, oh, what the hell? I own all the other ones. Yeah. I might as well. So I completely forgot about it. It showed up last week and I was like, oh yeah, forgot I ordered this.
Wow, Rob, you got a treasure that just keeps on giving. It's so glad it just showed up.
Josh Miller came over from Best Movies Never Made and we tossed it in with a glass of whiskey in hand. And I kind of had a blast.
Yeah, man.
Here's the thing. The Leprechaun movies are not good, really, but they're sort of entertaining. This one picks up immediately from the first one. So I love that that's the new trend, direct sequel from the original. They bring everybody back, like Mark Holton, the
guy from the first one.
The big guy from Teen Wolf and
Pee-wee
and all those movies. Mm-hmm. And it's Jennifer Aniston's daughter or her character's daughter. They even have Jennifer Aniston's voice, but it's not her. It's somebody that sounds, I had to look it up on IMDb. I was like,
oh wow.
That actually sounds like her on the phone right there. And yeah, it just continues from, but what I like about it, it's directed by the guy that did The Void, mm-hmm. who's super young. And when I watched his interview because he has an interview on it, and basically he's like, look, man, that's cool that there's like Conjuring movies and all that, but I just want a goofy, gory, fun movie. Like we need the Leprechauns of the world. And I'm like, you know what? Yeah, he's right. We do need some of these movies. Yeah, it's just a straightforward Leprechaun movie with, I mean, I don't know why they're trying to make that old house into a sorority house. Like, we were questioning the motivation.
Like a party house.
Why they were all there. But once he comes back, it's just a lot of fun. It's really gory, which mm-hmm. really threw me off guard. And not only that, I don't think it's all practical. There's like one CG thing towards the end that even that looked great.
Yeah.
But there's like really solid kills. And of course, he does his, you know, goofy one-liners and stuff.
He's got to clean the shoes.
Yeah, and he's fine. Yeah, actually, I forgot about that. And Josh Miller is like, remember his weakness is that he has to clean shoes? Somebody throws it out. I was like, wait, is that a true thing? He's like, yeah, it's in the first one. I was like, man, cracks I don't remember the first one.
I wonder if that was an Irish myth.
I don't – that leprechauns clean shoes? Yeah. I don't
like
know.
Like a cobbler thing, I wonder.
It's
but
in
that's gnomes.
A cobbler thing? What are you, yeah, what are you saying about leprechauns?
That's an old...
Mofo?
Yeah, gnomes. Or gnomes and leprechauns,
I don't even know what I'm saying.
Thing.
I'm so confused. Maybe I was being offensive.
Gnomes, leprechaun, where do elves fit into this equation? I need to know like the differences.
How was the person who took over the role?
I thought he was fine. He's good. Yeah. His voice changes a lot. So it's not as consistent as like, you know, what me and Josh were talking about. It's like Warwick Davis is just one of those actors that he was in the right place at the right time for all those roles we know him for, Willow and Leprechaun and all that. And like, he just rolled with it and made it his. So I thought he did the new guy was fine, you know? I mean, it's a Leprechaun movie. There's not much to ask for. Better than Origins. Let's just say that.
Best sequel?
Of the franchise. Oh, yeah, by far.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not saying best sequel in general.
Although, you know, it's
Back
like,
to the Hood.
Better than Empire Strikes Back.
Lep in the Hood come to do no good, guys.
So, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sure.
But I do want to ask Rodman Flender how he feels that they skipped over his part two and started. They just went straight to from one to this. None of them exist in between. You know,
that's what everybody said about Rick Rosenthal and Us.
Oh, yeah, that's right. People are getting used to it now. So I want that Aliens, Alien. Yeah, right. No, Aliens. That was such a controversial, just like everyone was saying, what's his name? The Blomkin was going to do the new Alien, but like ignore all of them. Oh, yeah. And everyone's like, you can't do that. And now I'm glad that several franchises proved you can.
Well, now we got Terminator.
That's true.
Terminator is just like, skip over all that nonsense.
Yep.
Pick up from two.
Yep.
James Sounds Cameron's good. Here to tell you.
I want to see Sigourney one more time.
The guy who did Deadpool.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good. Good cred.
Becca, hit me with some Manitou.
Okay. Well, I've got a whole list here, so I'm going to burn through some of these. I loved The Perfection. I heard that it was very polarizing in the group.
I forgot you've been away for all of this.
I've been away for like 3 weeks.
You're like the biggest fan of this. I mean, outside of
Rock. I love The Perfection. They actually interviewed me on Inside Edition talking about The Perfection and analyzing. Yeah. So if you go back through Inside Edition, you can probably find it on the website.
I feel like that title might come up again today later on in your.
I have a feeling it will too. So I absolutely loved it. It was just my perfect mix of gore in camp, and I don't know what the fuck is going on, and it was like my ideal rape revenge movie, and it felt really
South
Korean.
And it feels
Korean.
Like a Lifetime movie.
Yeah, it was like a Lifetime movie, yeah. Like completely off the rails.
Speaking of Lifetime movies, Becca, we haven't talked to you since your movie
I made a movie and
Psycho
it came
Grand
out, guys.
By the way, I watched it that morning, the morning after. I did.
In the morning? Wow.
Well, the morning after it debuted to your outfit that night, but Jesus Christ, that was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Yeah.
No, I mean, I genuinely mean that. Like a Lifetime movie, it's like once I settled in and when she was like, I forgot who plays the psycho granny.
That would be Robin.
Riker.
Riker.
From Alligator.
Yeah.
When she saw is like when she targets that woman and she's like, oh hey, I was like, oh here we go, she's gonna pretend she's like our relative somehow.
No, there is no spoilers because part of the, like, they give you.
I saw someone killed on live set, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
With needles.
But they give you, like, the formula that they want you to follow, and that movies all kind of have the same feel to them. And one of them is that you know who the killer is in the cold open. Yeah, so there's a cold open, but you know who the killer is going.
Well, we can't plug our own shit on the show. So, all right, moving on.
Okay. Get a bad iTunes
Well, thank you. Yeah.
Congrats,
so, Psycho Granny. Now on Lifetime. Anyway, so.
Smooth. Oh, so now.
Work that
on Blu-ray.
So anyway, perfection. I absolutely loved it. Then I took off to New York. I was in Virginia for a stretch, and I also spent some time in New York, took my kids to my old neighborhood and everything. And while I was there, I went to see Beetlejuice the musical, which I was completely intrigued by because I'd seen a lot of these other kind of movies that had been turned into musicals. And I first wanted to make sure that it wasn't too scary for my kid. And so I talked to a bunch of people online, and they were like, no, there's a lot of cursing. There's some cocaine references, but nothing scary. And I was like, cool that, you know, she gets all that at home. A lot of cocaine references flying around the house. Anyway, so I went to see Beetlejuice. It completely strays from the source material. The plot for Beetlejuice the musical is nothing like the original movie. And they even make jokes about it where Beetlejuice will stop and be like, we're straying so far from the source material. But the setup of it is that Lydia's mother has just died and that her dad has purchased this old house where the Maitlands passed away. They die in the house in it. And Beetlejuice is there and Lydia moves in. And at first, Beetlejuice teams up with the Maitlands to try to teach them how to be scary so they can kick everybody out of their house, so they can scare everybody out. So it becomes like the three of them working together. And then after the Maitlands get pissed off at him and think that he's like just a shyster, then he teams up with Lydia to try to get her father to sell the house to scare everybody. And at one point, they take over the house and like fill it with ghosts. And so it's a completely different plot. But that said, it was fucking bonkers fun. Like, I had such a good time with it.
Did they sing Deo?
They did. So that was the other thing, is they definitely, that was the only thing that I kind of bumped with, which I have a feeling that a lot of people loved. But it felt like the writers went out of their way to go, what are the quintessential moments of Beetlejuice? How do we really exploit and push those? So they sang both Deo and Jump in the Line were actual music numbers in the stage production. They must have said the I Myself Am Strange and Unusual line like four times. Like, it kept coming back. Well, you're the strange and unusual one.
Did they turn it into a song?
No, it was not. A lot of the songs.
Myself.
Rise adding it right now. But some of the quintessential lines that you remember from Beetlejuice became focal points. Like, they really did make them stand out in the stage production, which I was kind of like, oh, I wish you guys hadn't necessarily done that because it did seem to stand out from the rest of it. But at the same time, those are the ones that the people in the audience like really cheered on. Like, every single time they said the strange and unusual line, the audience went nuts. A lot of the music feels kind of Repo-ish, like Repo, the Genetic Opera. There's this one song called Dead Mom, which just made, cause she's talking about her dead mom, which really sounded Repo, the Genetic Opera-ish. It's got this strong rock feel to it. It feels kind of punk. Whoever was playing, Beetlejuice is absolutely amazing. He was nominated for a Tony Award for it. Mm. Yeah. And so it's a completely different plot line, but that said, what they do, it still has the same level of effects. Like, the sandworms are still in there. Beetlejuice still grows to giant proportions at various points during the production. There's still crazy stuff that happens. There's still jump scares on stage. The set design and the production design of it were what impressed me out of all of it. I was so impressed with all
of
that.
Will it last?
I am not sure. Right now it's at one of the smaller theaters. It's at the Winter Garden. It started, I think it did its debut at the Warner in DC, and then it moved to the Winter Garden. And out of all of the theaters on Broadway Row, the Winter Garden's one of the smaller ones. I have a feeling it'll stay there for a while. I mean, I was at like a 2 o'clock on a Tuesday and it was completely sold out. Mm. So yeah. And it did just get nominated. The award show was on June 9th, I think, because I watched it. But it got nominated for like 3 Academy Awards. So I have a feeling it'll be around for a while Tony Awards. So it'll be around for a little while.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Beetlejuice the musical, please check it out. Anybody?
Oh, yeah.
I got more.
I can talk about a little film called Trapped Alive.
Oof. Oh, I can join you on that conversation.
I know you can. Your letterbox told me you rated it 1.5 stars.
Great cover. It's like The Slayer. Remember The Slayer?
I'm looking
great
up cover. The cover.
Great cover.
I wanted to watch that movie hard.
This is one of those Arrow releases where I'm kind of like, man, it's an Arrow release. So obviously I'm going to throw my time investment into this and watch it. And obviously it's a film I've never heard before.
Oh, that is a good cover.
It's a great cover. Now I'm at this point where I'm like, man, I really dislike this movie, but I want to keep it in the collection in case I need to reach for it for something. I don't know what that would be. But basically the scenario is this. 3 convicts break out of a prison. They kidnap 2 women on their way to a Christmas party. While they're driving along in the woods, they come across a piece of real estate that used to – there was like an old mine there. And then these dummies keep driving over the treacherous terrain. And sure enough, these dummies break through the ground. Their SUV goes into one of the mine shafts. They get trapped under there. Near the hole in the ground, there's a house, and there's kind of a kooky woman that lives there.
A bored housewife.
Yeah, a bored housewife.
Because her husband's sleeping the whole movie.
It's the whole movie.
And she's like this, like, she's over, like, undersexed, oversexed.
Way oversexed.
And when she enters the story, it gets crazy.
She enters the story when a deputy comes along looking for these two women that had been kidnapped. And before you know it, the cop and her having sex in the room next to her sleeping husband. And then basically you get the story of these two girls and these three convicts underground arguing a lot, trying to figure out how to get out of the mine, how to start the generator. And then there's a point where they introduce a cannibal and he's picking people off one by one by using a big hook.
Yeah, I think it's stronger if you see it as a prequel to The Descent. Like, if you just listen to everything he just said, but then watch the scene, you'd be like, oh, that's how it started. Origin story to like this dumb cannibal
and
thing.
What was strange is I've never heard of this movie. I've never seen a trailer for this movie. It came out in like early 90s and it was shot
pretty well. Like, photographically, it's fine.
Oh, no.
It's competently made.
The color scheme is beautiful. Yeah, it's like lots of yellows and blues, blue hues, but it was shot like on a stage somewhere in Wisconsin.
Oh, I didn't know that part.
Something like that. It was like
That's why I was watching with Dick and he bought it because it was a Wisconsin
film.
That's right. You're right.
Yeah. It was shot in like northern Wisconsin in like a sound stage where they built the mine shaft and all that stuff. And there's a great special feature on there that's like Upper Michigan Tonight. And it's two reporters talking about Hollywood has come to Wisconsin. Yeah. And I'm like, wait a minute, you're Upper Michigan.
Yeah.
And I say that with love because I used to live in Traverse City. But man, this movie is a fucking drag.
It's just not paced.
It's got no soul. It's got no motor.
And everyone's over the top.
Everybody's so over the top.
I will say, like, we're all so bored. And there's a quiet moment towards the end where this is a spoiler, but who cares? You're just looking at the water and I'm like, guys, if right now somebody jumps out boogaboos out of the water, this movie's worthwhile. 10 seconds later, boogaboo. I was like, that's almost worth it.
But the funny thing,
cannibal out of the water.
And then they've got Cameron Mitchell.
I know, as the dad.
As the dad of one of the two girls that gets kidnapped. And
but he never even enters the action of the story.
He doesn't do a thing in this fucking movie. And then they cut to him after throwing his own holiday party. And he gets a call from the police. And he's like, well, please find them. I need to find my daughter. And then he has like a fucking like a monologue with a picture of his dead wife. And he's like, sweetheart, I done wrong. Yeah. I lost her. I did the thing that I swear I never do. I lost her and we got to get her back. Baby, I'll get her back. And I'm like, this is how you got Cameron Mitchell. You wrote a fucking monologue of him talking to his dead, a photograph of his dead wife.
And he was doing a show in Wisconsin that night.
Yeah.
And you got him at a nominal fee. No, I mean, if this had come out as a Vinegar Syndrome, I wouldn't have been, I'd be like, oh, that makes sense for them because they're saving movie. But as an Arrow, you're like, really? But then you go, oh, Slayer flashback.
Okay, yeah, you know, seriously. And also the cannibal himself, the makeup is awful.
It's really weird.
So awful.
And he's not very menacing and he moves slowly. I don't know. But the wacky woman is interesting. When she comes in, the oversexed housewife we're talking about, she is pretty wacky.
No, she's got her own monologue.
Yeah,
and
it's kind of a good
performance,
like compared to everyone else, but it's also kind of terrible.
She's super extra. It's
must see.
No.
Is it approved?
Is this like a Blood Hook or a Doom Asylum?
It got 1.5 stars from me.
Shut your mouth.
I have not seen Doom Asylum yet. I still have it. It's sitting
on my
desk.
Doom Asylum is fucking Jaws compared to this movie.
Oh, damn.
Wow. That is a shining endorsement for Doom Asylum.
Yeah.
What was the other title?
It's fucking Jaws.
What did you also say?
Blood Hook.
Oh, Jesus. That movie is like...
You like Blood Hook a lot, though.
Silence of the Lambs.
Blood Hook is Silence of the Lambs.
Only the really long Dash version Ryan of Blood Hook.
We found our new barometer. It's Trapped Alive, I guess.
Trapped Alive. Fuck that movie.
Microwave Massacre.
Microwave Massacre is like, I could see why somebody would like that, though, because it like tries hard with lots of different... It's just so not my kind of movie. But that one's like, it's got comedy, and if you liked that, you might like the movie, but it's terrible. This just is like a flatline, right?
Yeah. Becca, what's your last thing?
Okay, well, I got two I'll drop super quick and then the one that I saw with Elric. So I watched The Manitou, Scream Factory, Blu-ray release. I love this one so much. It definitely, it feels old. It feel, like you can feel
you
the
feel
age.
Old.
But no, you but that said, old. It's fucking awesome. It definitely has this woman who is much like, I'm going in for a medical procedure because I seem to be growing a tumor on my shoulder. And then as soon as she says that, the men take over controlling her, which kind of became my read on it, was it was all about men controlling this woman's body, including the one that is growing inside of her.
Girdler's deep.
So yeah, so some deep girdler's
ahead of his time.
Because suddenly this guy who is not her boyfriend or husband starts making medical decisions for her and arguing with the doctor over who gets to make those medical decisions. But yeah, Tony Curtis.
Wearing interesting clothes all the way through. He's like a psychic.
Yeah, he's a fake psychic.
Fake psychic, yeah.
Greatest Burgess Meredith moment ever in the history of cinema.
I agree.
He's in it for about 5 minutes playing some type of professor who is expert on Native American folklore. And I have a feeling that they gave him like three lines and somehow he stretched it into the greatest character basically ever in the history of cinema. So that was just amazing. The end scene had a lot of lasers in it and the Manitou's
8,000-year-old
shaman.
It's a cool movie.
It is. Yeah. You know what? If I can throw a 4th of July party, it would be Manitou themed and you would all step into kind of like a, what was a planetarium?
The
planetarium. And it would just be the lasers and Manitou's and Tony Curtis.
And he's laughing because he doesn't like, he'll put his hands up like this and then he laughs.
He's
and
like,
that's all.
Brian, welcome to the organizational board of Girdlerthon. You have just talked your way into being on our advisory board.
I'm the OG Girdler fan. I mean,
Grizzly
is amazing. Abby.
The sad part about that is like, because Manitou was quite a big movie, like in terms of like the budget compared to what he had made. He was working on like his like 10 times bigger sci-fi epic and location scouting when he died. So it's like, oh, we could have seen another extra. And he was like fucking 34.
He was super young.
Had made like 10 films.
And he died and it was a helicopter accident?
Helicopter.
Yeah.
Wow.
Were there more Manitou books?
Yes. William Masterson. There's a whole series of books.
Novels. So this happens again?
I don't know. I haven't read them, but I just know it was a series.
Just heads up. My birthday is October 1st.
Yeah. Okay.
But I love your idea of doing that. Listeners. A July 4th party. That is cool.
Yeah.
The Manitou 4th of July bash.
No, it was. It's definitely a fun movie. There was not a moment in it that I was bored, even when, you know, the laser scene came in at the end for like 20 minutes. They're just stars and lasers.
I just love that Tony Curtis is just chewing the scenery with everyone.
Oh my God. Oh. Well, yeah. And then Burgess Meredith comes in and somehow outdoes that.
And who's the shaman? I forgot who the actor is. He's like really good.
I did not know that was
I assume he's a real shaman.
Yeah. So it's just a trip across the board. So the Blu-ray is out now from Scream Factory. So highly recommend that. And then I saw just two nights ago, I watched A Mill of the Stone Women. This is a real kind of quiet horror from 1960. Italian. Somebody on my Facebook page wrote it's the best Hammer film that was not made by Hammer, and that really does sum it up.
I'd never heard this really title gothic-y. You posted.
This one, I had not even heard of this until a couple of weeks ago when I was researching for another project and happened upon the poster and was like, what is this? I thought it was a book cover. And then I saw the poster and was like, this looks amazing. Hunted down a copy of it. There's a decent DVD out. I don't think it got a very widespread release, but the DVD is definitely available. Was directed by Giorgia Ferroni, who went on to do a ton of films after this, but he specialized in the sword and sandal movies and spaghetti westerns. So was just as prolific during this time, came up kind of right alongside Bava and the rest, but yeah, definitely kind of went with the other subgenres. The whole concept of it is that this writer goes to this really remote island in Holland to research this art project, this like art thing that has been set up by this professor called the Mill of Stone Women, which is all of these people on this kind of conveyor belt that move throughout this entire mill. It's pretty cool looking. And the professor's daughter is sick and they're working on a cure for that. But then all these people in the town start going missing. And it's definitely slowly paced. It feels like a Hammer film, but at the same time, it's really cool. It's got some really tight visuals to it. It's got a really nice twist at the end. So I do recommend, if you are into your gothic horrors, hunting down Mill of the Stone Women. And that brings me to what Elric and I saw last night.
Oye.
Oye.
We saw Midsommar.
Midsommar.
We will very much. I think we won't go into it very much at all.
Yeah,
because they're going to see it, and we don't be spoiler free. But I'll say the cool things as somebody I hadn't seen anything. I didn't even see a trailer. I saw a couple images. I thought it was set. I thought it was set way in the past. I didn't realize it was a contemporary movie. So at the start, the setup to this movie is really. I thought it was really modern and fun. I really liked it because Hereditary is about family. This is just about young people and the relationships and loss. And there's,
it's still about grief.
It is. It's still completely about grief
and empathy. Like those two themes are still the biggest ones.
And it's a breakup movie, and it's a really accurate depiction of a real time, slow moving. I don't know how to break up with my partner kind of girlfriend. I'm in my mid-20s, and as bad as the guy is, there's moments where I could identify with him, and there's moments I could identify with her. And I was like, oh, this.
And
is
then
really
there was
well.
Moments I was like, oh, they're going to stay together. And then other moments where I was like, why are they together?
But so, that's just so little of the movie. That's really just how you get into the movie. Something really big happens at the start, and then you're going to this kind of summer fest. And
it's a group of kids that head off to Sweden and some type of summer fest in Sweden. And I wore my dress.
She's dressed like
I'm dressed like Midsommar today, because while I was watching it, I was like, I think I own that garb. And so I'll do my silent clap that they do in the movie. They do this throughout the movie. It's their silent clap.
But what's cool about it is
Becca's basically doing the equivalent of jazz hands.
Jazz hands. But this is, it's silent clap. Silent clap.
But for people on the fence, what's cool?
On a scale of zero to Wicker Man, how Wicker Man is it?
It's more Wicker Man than Wicker Man.
All the way. I mean, it's not quite as serious a tone as Wicker Man. What is so cool about this movie and why I liked it so much is it's really funny. I found like myself laughing a lot in the first 30 minutes in the setup. And then once you get there, there's so much absurdism, black humor. But what I really like about it is the closest comparison for anyone I wonder what this is going to be like without spoiling. This is, I think, us to Get Out, this is to Hereditary. It's that different.
Yeah.
It's a totally, there are huge swings. It's maybe not quite as successful. Well, it's not as successful. Yeah. Horror film is Hereditary, but it is a really visionary, interesting picture.
And I can say, whereas Hereditary like sweeped and everybody across the board was like, this is the horror film of the year, I don't think Midsommar is going to do that.
No, it's going to be an obscure art house, weirdo.
Yeah, because it is. You know? It's weird. It's slow at times. There were moments where I was like, I don't know what's going on and nothing's happening. But
it's
still
intense
and
there's some really crazy shit that goes down. So, and he's a great voice, an interesting voice.
Yeah, going in, and we talked about this afterwards, whereas Hereditary, I felt like I was in the hands of a madman and I never had a clue what was coming next. Like every single moment of that film, I was like, holy shit, I can't believe that just happened. There was not moments like that in Midsommar. Like,
you know,
everything felt very like you knew that was going to happen from the very beginning.
I think that's because also because of how many movies we watch and like things like Blood on Satan's Claw and Wicker Man especially. I think I'd love to know a general audience who's never seen a movie like Wicker Man.
Like the pastoral English.
Exactly. And especially just where those kind of movies go to, you're heading towards something big. I feel like that would be fascinating to know. How somebody who's like, holy shit, I've never seen anything like this. Because it delivers on those kind of angles.
Yeah,
but I agree, we've seen a lot of this before.
Yeah.
But it's really cool. And I'm excited that we have a couple filmmakers. And it's cool that they're in the new Fango talking to each other. I can't wait to read that.
Mm-hmm.
But I love that we've got these guys taking major left turn swings and movies that are equal in the kind of scope, but just so different.
Yeah, it still feels
so I'm excited
like
for people to see it.
It still feels like an Ari Aster film, but it feels
totally.
Nothing like Hereditary. The pacing, the scares, the brutality, it's all completely different.
Yeah, and that's A24 and coming out.
A24
in about,
is doing it.
July 3rd, I think.
Can't wait.
Yeah.
So it should be good. A.
A.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. Well.
So that's Sweden covered.
Yeah.
So, hey guys, you want to go to camp?
Where are we going?
Camp.
To get campy.
Let's go get campy.
I'll catch
Camp
a plane,
blood?
But I will regret it. Well, actually, this is good. I get to listen to the second half of this episode, which I never get to, because you guys are great. We love you guys.
Oh, thanks. That'll work.
Not you guys. I'm talking to Brandon across the way.
Camp Blood? All right. Well, we'll be back after these advertisers.
Graveyard Slaughter would like to tell you about their upcoming Kickstarter campaign. If you're old enough, you remember the joy of wandering the blissfully bloody aisles of the horror selection at your local video rental store. Not those big, brightly lit stores like Blockbuster either. The hole-in-the-wall shops. The shops where you could find some deep-dive horror movies. Well, welcome to video hell. Lunchbox Press proudly invites you back to those video stores of old and presents Graveyard Slaughter, currently on Kickstarter. Graveyard Slaughter is a comic book anthology that's dripping with sloppy, oozy, gooey 1980s VHS gore. Over 50 terrifying pages of madness co-written by New York Times best-selling author Colin Bunn and Kevin Watkins. Art provided by legendary ghostwriter artist Javier Saltares, rising star Pumpkinhead artist Blackie Shepherd, Gary Bedall, and Adam McLaughlin. Introduction provided by Bram Stoker award-winning and best-selling author Paul Tremblay. Graveyard Slaughter will be running on Kickstarter all through June. Back the comic today and unlock all of the super rad stretch goals exclusive only to Graveyard Slaughter Kickstarter backers. Lunchbox Press proudly presents Graveyard Slaughter on Kickstarter in June. And remember, always, be kind, rewind, or die. Just head to Kickstarter.com and search for Graveyard Slaughter today.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is also sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from all around the world. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head right on over to Diabolik DVD, where you could find awesome releases from Vinegar Syndrome, including Dark Room, The Suckling, and Grandmother's House. You can also find all of the AGFA and Something Weird titles, including Ninja Zombie, Blood Lake, and Lady Street Fighter. From Garage House Pictures, both Supercock and Foes. And also all of the latest releases from Scream Factory, including The Brain, Seven, Golden Vampires, When a Stranger Calls Back, The Chosen, and Superstition. So for all of your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to DiabolikDVD.com or find them on Facebook.
Tonight's Shockwaves is also brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service, super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic, irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest growing human curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. It is the Netflix of horror, but I think it's more than that, actually. To try Shudder free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES. And that is Shudder, S-H-U-D-D-E-R.
This episode is also brought to you by Fangoria. In July of 1979, the first issue of Fangoria was released into the world. And now, this summer, Fangoria magazine is turning 40 and celebrating accordingly with its fourth issue. 100 pages of exclusive, carefully curated content honoring horror's past, present, and future. These articles and interviews will never be published online, so the only way to read them is by getting your hands on a physical, collectible copy of your own. We can't give away anything yet, because we want you to experience it for yourself, but we can safely say that you do not want to miss a single page in issue number 4, because we're celebrating in style. Head over to Fangoria.com, that's Fangoria.com, to learn more and subscribe. And if you subscribe today, your subscription starts with the 40th anniversary issue, issue number 4, shipping in July. Use the code SHOCKWAVES to save 10% off your subscription. That's SHOCKWAVES for 10% off over at Fangoria.com.
Welcome back. We have a packed house here in the conference room.
Crossover.
This is a crossover episode. And
hell
good
yeah.
Timing, too. All right, we're going to do an Attack of the Queer Wolf sound off. To my left.
Brennan.
To my right.
Renee.
Sam.
Michael.
Da-da-da-da.
Welcome!
It's the crossover we've all been waiting for. What are we talking about, guys? First off, plugs. Let's talk about your upcoming screening.
Oh, yes. So this airs Friday. So tonight, the 21st,
correct,
we have a live show after a screening of a Sleepaway Camp 2 at the Frida in Santa Ana. Get your tickets right now, because you're listening to this first thing Friday morning. And then get in your car and drive down. You're going to need to leave now.
The Frida. But the Frida is worth it. That is
really
such
is
a bomb theater. It's
tickets
so cool.
Tickets are $10. You know, it's Sleepaway Camp 2, problematic fave. We're going to do a cool live show after. There'll be giveaways, prizes, fun stuff, maybe even a guitar.
My mom will be there. My dad will be there.
Oh, wow. And that alone.
Aww. Very excited.
But it's all family's coming. That's
and
adorable.
Then, I think my sister, who knows?
Yeah. Sam, I think, has a thing or two more about it, right?
Just that our giveaways are from Fright Rags. Super pumped. After they did the Pride t-shirts with the Rainbow Fangoria mm-hmm. logo. Mm-hmm. And they've given us a couple of donations. So, yeah.
Cool.
8:30. Love the Frida.
Oh, yeah. I should have said the time.
Also, we'll see you guys in a few minutes.
All right. So for those who have never heard of this podcast, explain to our listeners, the Shockwaves listeners, what Attack of the Queerwolf is all about.
Attack of the Queerwolf is a raucous horror podcast. I mean, we are all people who identify as queer, and most, if not all, of our guests are the same. We get straight people in sometimes. We allow them entry upon occasion.
Yes, we do.
You guys asked me.
I mean, if you're a real bad bitch, you can come.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Okay. Yeah. I think she just called me a bad bitch.
I did.
I won't that fucking own that shit.
Yeah.
That excludes me.
Yeah. But yeah, we take a look at movies of the present and the past with either queer characters or queer subtext or maybe none of that. And we, you know, just apply a queer lens to it. And I don't know. I'm making it sound really dry, but it's incredibly vulgar and also incredibly informative. So you should check it out. Yeah.
Terrific previous guests include
Chris Landon,
Don Mancini,
Katya.
Katya,
yeah,
and from Drag RuPaul. Race.
Jordan Cruciola
from Vulture. Jordan's
the best. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know Jordan was on.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. Yeah.
What movie did we talk about with her?
Seed of Chucky.
Yes.
Oh,
good
episode. Yeah.
We've had some great guests.
Brian Fuller.
Yes. Yeah, Brian. He was on to discuss Fright Night.
Yep.
MJ Bassett.
Who else?
Jen Moorman.
Oh, yeah. She's incredible. She's a horror academic. She was featured in Eli Roth's documentary.
Okay.
You got to listen to her take on Alien 3.
It's pretty great.
It's breathtaking.
Yeah, it really is. Wow. It was like one of the first episodes we did where we as hosts kind of left and went, holy shit, this show can be something more than just four queer people laughing it up for an hour. She was an amazing guest, but she also talked about her cancer. I think she had it twice and how she connected to Alien 3, and like just listening to her talk about it was stunning. Mm-hmm. Like it's so like, it was an amazing show. It's one of my favorite.
Yeah. And that and also Nay's general aura as a human being have kind of opened the floor for us to be very vulnerable about what it's like to be queer in 2019 and kind of talk about our own lives through the lens of these movies.
Yeah. And when do you guys, our episodes drop on Friday? When does
Thursdays? Yeah, so have us
we
for an app.
You.
And yeah, we can be your app, and Shockwaves can be your meal the next day.
Yeah, I'll take that.
I'll take that.
Now we went in with a mission. Have we done our homework for this episode,
or
was this a slapdash? Well, I'll just come up with some titles off the top of my head.
I have homework, guys.
Excellent.
I'm OCD.
Always has homework.
Of course I do.
Never have homework because I have access to the IMDb at all times.
No,
I see you have it up right now.
But this is why Brennan worked for me and why I knew he would make an amazing producer for this. Because he also did homework.
I have two full notebook pages.
At the start of the week, I sent out an email to the group and I said, what are we talking about? And then Brennan was like, I got you right here. And then I said, this is the homework. So Brennan, why don't you explain what we're talking about this episode?
Well, I've previously been on Shockwaves. And we talked about the kind of general topic of LGBTQ horror. And I was like, it's Pride Month. I want to get really granular into this kind of thing. So I suggested we talk about camp. And we kind of all narrowed down exactly how we're going to talk about it. But I just thought it'd be really fun to talk about what camp is, how it's applied to horror, like when it works best and worst. And yeah.
Well, why don't you lead? What do you got? Do you want to go title by title, or do you want to go by...
He just reads a list.
Actually, I have some questions.
Let him go first.
All right, but just so you get context of what we're looking at. If you remember the beginning of Seven, when you see John Doe's scribblings in his diary of all the killings and all his anger about the world, that is Brennan's book.
No, Brennan's
I do have the handwriting of a serial killer.
It's very neat, though.
And it literally says
serial killer
top,
slant.
Camp.
Well, I have some questions that I wanted to start off with that I don't necessarily have answers to, but they're really good talking points for me because I've always had problems separating camp from cult because they kind of get lumped into the same category. And I hear films called cult films and then I hear them called camp films. And so I was trying to kind of discern what the definition between the two of them was today. And so I started doing all this research. And with cult, most people seem to think that it kind of had to be like something that was made at one time, completely fell asleep, and then another group of people kind of discovered it, rediscovered it, and brought it back to life. Whereas camp, I read all of these different definitions for it. Like some people said that it had to be so good it's bad, or so bad it's good. Some people said that it had to be made unintentionally bad, but we perceive it as bad, or made unintentionally funny, but we perceive it as funny. But then that knocks out things like Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, which I consider to be a camp movie, but they knew going in that they were making it funny. And so I'm trying to figure out like a solid definition. So guys, what is camp?
Well, camp is a really slippery topic.
It's also very open to interpretation, if you ask me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a feeling... I would like to read a quote from an academic piece, and then I would like to throw it to the queer wolves to kind of respond with their own perspectives on it, because also part of being queer is bringing your own perspective to everything that exists in the world. but so this is from the 1964 piece Notes on Camp by Susan Sontag.
I love you, Brennan. I love you.
But yeah, this was the piece that also inspired the Met Gala's theme this year.
Yeah, oh, is that just, what the theme was?
Yeah, well, yeah. Look what happens when you invite a lot of straight people to your camp party.
Right. Well, what is Frank Ocean's excuse? Okay, know. Looking like the valet driver.
You're right.
What would you have worn?
Oh, wow. I don't even, wouldn't even fit in this room, probably.
That is the best answer.
I'm just stuck in my imagination about that now.
Yeah,
here's a tiny, tiny snippet because it's a long article, but I recommend everyone check it out. It's free online. Camp is a vision of the world in terms of style, but a particular kind of style. It is the love of the exaggerated, the off of things being what they are not.
And that in itself is a really vague definition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what I learned from that article is that there's kind of a difference between kitsch and camp. Mm-hmm. Kitsch is a style of creation. It is a form. Like kitsch is a sign you hang up in your kitchen that says it's 1 o'clock somewhere. Like it's authentic to someone, but it's trash.
Exactly.
And some listener is staring at that sign in their kitchen right now going,
I'm betting it's a white lady.
But camp is if I see that sign at a store and buy it because I think it's hilarious. So camp is your what you bring to it as a viewer, and kitsch is what it is.
So camp can be different for everybody. Yep. Like my dad has a, I'm not kidding, a clock shaped like a fish because he genuinely loves the clock. But every single time I go home, I'm like, I'm going to take that because I consider it to be the weirdest looking clock.
That
ever.
Would be camp in your house.
That's, okay.
That's a huge element of the Sontag piece, actually.
Excellent.
Like
okay.
Things that look like other things.
But I feel
which I love.
But I feel like camp can be pushed too far. Like you go into a film going, I'm going to make the campiest thing possible. And then it's like
the
trying
thing
to
is
create a boogeyman.
You can't, you know, because the camp depends on the viewer.
Well, what about like, because there are films that were made that were intentionally made like that, like Lost Skeleton of Catavera. Do you guys remember that one?
Yeah.
Like that one they had made. There were parts of it that I really, really like. I enjoyed what he was trying to do, but I think Grindhouse was trying for the same thing.
Well, that's a good point.
Like
for me, there's an aspect of camp too. Like I always look at The Fan. Like we did an episode on The Fan,
and the 1981 The Fan.
Yes,
not the
1981 The Fan. For me, that is a camp because oh my god, I'm blanking on her name,
Lauren Bacall.
To me, Lauren Bacall. I consider that movie camp because she's like in a completely different genre than the rest of the people making that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's in a musical.
Like her performance and everything, it's like she didn't know she was in a slasher movie. She's like, you know what I mean? And I'm like, to me, that's like an element of camp. Like it's not intentionally camp, but like she made that shit camp just by showing up on set. Right. But then you have also like Drag Race is like a really good example of a show that can do intentional camp, but does it really well. But there is a fine line, like Ryan was kind of saying, like if you go in and you overreach for your camp, you just kind of become boring.
Well, I think you could just feel the inauthenticity to it. You know, if you're someone, I see a lot of films that go in and they're like, I'm going to make something really kooky and campy. And I'm like, you know what? I don't believe you. I don't see the heart in this. I don't see the heart and soul. Whereas if I watch something like Terror Vision and I'm like, Terror Vision is an incredibly campy movie because you've got what's her face from Better Off Dead running around with her pigtails and color hair, and she's being like 80s girl, and you've got the monster that loves watching TV and all the shit. And I'm like, this is incredibly campy, but it's also speaking to me and I love it. But then I'll watch something that's just like, I don't know. I mean, like The Lost Skeleton, you know,
Catawba.
Like I just, I didn't get it. Like, I mean, and I grew up watching those movies, mm-hmm. and I understand there was a time and place for those. But when you're like intentionally going in for that, I don't know. It just lost me.
But then I think that some of the movies that intentionally go in for it do it quite well. I mean, even John Waters, who I consider to be kind of the godfather of camp, knew damn yes. well what he was doing, yep. even from the start.
Yeah.
Sam. Oh, Ryan Larson. Do you want to share my microphone for a sec? You can tell.
Hi,
you
Ryan.
Did this research. But really quick, before we do that,
Sam
has been like jumping out of his seat. I want you to share your perspective on it really quick.
Yeah.
Well, Brian Fuller says that camp is an art that comes from brokenness. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a perspective to look at that where coming from the artist, being having something broken and identifying something broken in somebody else's art, that's kind of where, to me, camp gets interesting. And so when you're talking about it, Ryan, as far as things that work and don't work for you, that's the difference between interesting and boring for me. Something interesting, having a piece of me, and especially this is where it connects to queer identity, having a piece of me that I see in the work itself.
Actually, I want to hear a little bit more about that because, I mean, obviously we've seen throughout time, even going back to John Waters, that queer tends to kind of fall into the same camp categories that they get associated together a lot, especially within media for some reason. And so why is that? Like, what is the thing that kind of links the two or creates the fascination?
Well, that's a really big conversation that we're going to have. But first, I really want Ryan to share his tidbit that he found in his research. This is Ryan Larson, editor-in-chief of GaslightGrinning.com.
So I'm staying with Brendan actually right now, and he – oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Oh, hey. Yeah,
I'm staying with Brendan right now, and so last night I'm all laid up on his air mattress. Okay. I looked like Burt Reynolds in that one photo, but clothed. And he's like, we need to talk about camp. So we're talking about it. So we were like trying to find movies, and I was same as you guys. I'm like, I don't really know what defines camp. And so researching it, I found out that it is derived from – French slang, which is say campaire, which means to strike an exaggerated pose, which I think is actually kind of
That actually makes a lot of sense.
That makes things so much clearer to me.
That sums it up.
Yeah.
And I think what you were saying about authenticity is like the biggest part of it, in that when people make stuff or they create art or they create this vision from their experiences or from their brokenness, it reaches certain people because of those shared experiences, and it might miss others because they just don't have that in common. But someone who creates that because they watch other people create it and they don't necessarily have those experiences, maybe that's what comes out as boring or like corny.
Totally.
Or,
Yeah, it's an adaptation.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, going back to The Fan, would you say The Fan overall is campy, or her performance just brings
the
level
as soon as the gay boys start dancing on the stage saying they're in love with her, the movie's one.
I haven't seen The Fan in a while, but I was thinking about campy performances, and I was thinking about Nightmare on Elm Street. And everybody's bringing their A-game, but then Ronnie Blakely comes on, and she's like, hello, darling. And she's got her robe on, and she's got her booze bottle. She's like, mommy did something bad. And it's like, oh, tell me about your mommy being bad.
It's so campy. But you know, we brought up Brian Fuller now like three times, but like listening to him to dissect her performance, you realize like, cause I always would say that to him, like she's super camp. And he's like, she's actually really tortured and broken. And like, when you look at it from those terms, you can kind of like see where there is no campiness in her performance whatsoever. So I guess it is kind of open to interpretation, but I've always said that performance is just high camp.
Yeah.
I've got something better. I'm going to get her some help.
Oh my God. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
So I'm also intrigued about how camp, can change over time. And I mean, I look at what is considered to be kind of like the first cult movie, although I'd argue that it isn't, but Reefer Madness is usually the one that's pointed to as being the first cult movie, made in the 1930s by Dwayne Esper. And it was actually made as like a, you know, tell your children not to smoke up. And then it was rediscovered by Normal in the 60s, who used it and did public screenings of it to help support legalization of marijuana. And so at that point it became camp.
They like because turned it on its own.
They turned it, yeah. And were, because it had no rights attached to it, so they could do these screenings of it. And but at that point it became a whole bunch of people smoking up and watching this movie and laughing at the guy, like, you know, trying to hump his mom while stoned, like you do. And so yeah, but it clearly changed over time, and I'm really intrigued, like even some of the hygiene films or some of the other ones that have really kind of transitioned, like what has to happen for that to take place as a society? Is it just kind of an evolution?
And does it change for everyone? Mm-hmm. Because I was shown that in the 90s, but as a serious, like...
You were shown Reefer Madness as serious?
But I also like grew up in a cornfield. Like, I had like a graduating class of four and was shown that movie as like...
Were you shown that in Christian school?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
So it's like those folks are so behind.
Did they show you guys his film Sex Madness?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Sex Madness blows Reefer Madness out of the water. Wow. Like, I can't believe this one does not get shown more. It is about a woman who has sex with an immigrant. He's nondescript immigrant, but he's definitely, you know, they definitely portray him as not from here. And she has unmarried sex with this immigrant, becomes pregnant. He has an STD. Now the baby has the STD, and then Satan shows up. It's just
the Tyler Perry movie. Wow.
Sex Madness. So yeah, it's nuts. Huh? I don't remember.
Baby turned into Roddy Blakely.
The whole movie. But the whole movie, I'm sure that it was made with good intentions, but maybe not. I don't know. It's totally racist and weird and misogynistic now, but you watch it now and you're like, oh my God, this movie's fucking off the rails. So Sex Madness.
Well, I think with things like that, I mean, they're indicative of the time. You know, like I watched, I was going through some of the Universal classic monster movies, and you know, a lot of those come across as campy just because that's what played so well at the time, and we've, you know, the society's evolved, entertainment has evolved. Mm-hmm. But oh yeah, there it is. Oh,
wow. She saw big thrills and caught big trouble. Sex Madness.
Damn, girl. But camp, I mean, like, I feel like in terms of the horror bubble, we identify things, and we could watch something like Evil Dead 2 and go, that's not campy. That's more like splatstick, like Raimi calls it. And it's like a horror comedy. It's a lot of fun. But someone outside of our circle will immediately identify and go, oh, that's just a campy horror movie.
Yep.
And I feel like that gets thrown around almost as a stigma as well.
As I was researching today, I found...
Those same people say elevated horror.
Oh, so my let's God. Just forget about fuck them. Those people. Hated shit.
Right.
No, as I was researching today, I found people calling Shaun of the Dead really campy. And really? I look at that and I'm like, no, that's like just a really damn good horror film. There's nothing campy about that.
And I think the comedy in it is really intelligent, too.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So do I.
Yeah. But that campy can't be intelligent. But I wouldn't call that a campy movie.
I wouldn't either. Yeah, that's one that I bumped with and was like, I think so.
I think general public just have that in their tote bag just to like throw that on onto throw onto horror movies as labels. You know, something.
But I think sometimes camp can be thrown around as a way to save a bad film. Mm-hmm. And so I know I personally have an aversion to hearing the word camp just because. Well, or maybe I should say camp in the hands of straight people. Sorry. But it's because it gets tossed around with, oh, you'll love this. This is a, you know, it's a holiday horror flick. It's campy. And you get there and it's like,
you're gay. You'll love it.
Oh, yeah. No, it just needed a second draft.
But like speaking of the time aspect of it all, too, like in researching for this week, I was looking back on like early 90s thrillers and like Sleeping with the Enemy, Basic Instinct, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. Like
these
all
are
of those
so
were
lifetime
like
films.
Right. They were like terror classics back in the day. And like you watch them now and you're like, this white lady camp up and up. Like,
oh my God. Yeah.
It's just straight up camp.
I wrote down,
but it's amazing.
Yeah. I wrote down Cherry Falls because that was one for me, which felt like some of those like early 90s thrillers. But then you've got Jay Moore doing his thing in it.
Oh, he's in a different movie.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And like to me, that's intentional camp done really well.
Yeah. I love that movie.
And it also, to me, intentional camp always tends, not always, but usually tends to go hand in hand with dark comedy, mm-hmm. which I think Cherry Falls had a lot of. And like, if you're not catching the wink, you miss a black comedy and then you kind of get in touch with the camp or vice versa. But I think either way, you're seeing something cool.
Well, those movies that you're talking about, Sleeping with the Enemy and The Rock's Cradle, those are campy due to time.
Yes, exactly.
So what are those movies that we embrace that were campy of the time that are still still campy today? They were made campy then.
I think camp is more about distance, if you're distant from the material. So in 2019, if you're watching something from the 30s, that was not made for you. But if you're watching something from now, like I watch a lot of what I call Christian kitsch, like evangelical campy movies. Those movies were not made for me.
I need some examples here. Oh my God. Because aside from Kirk Cameron and Left Behind, yeah. I literally know none.
Kirk Cameron Saving Christmas. Have you ever seen that?
I didn't know he'd saved Christmas. Wow.
It's a 70-minute diatribe about how materialism is good and godly.
great lie. Now Kirk Cameron's not coming on.
Ryan just did camp.
We lost Kirk Cameron as a guest. Good job.
Ernie's riding those volume levels, man.
But you've got Christian Mingle starring Lacey Chabert, where they go to a restaurant called Steaks and Cakes.
I've actually
seen where they serve steaks and also cakes.
That sounds delicious.
You've got Wish for Christmas, about a girl who wishes that her parents were atheists so she could go to a party on Christmas Eve.
Did you just watch Hallmark?
What?
Did you just watch Hallmark?
Yeah, these sound like the films from Hallmark.
But if we're going to talk about modern camp that is intentionally campy, something like Netflix Princess Switch, right? I mean, like this is a whole genre. I mean, really, though.
I've watched Princess Switch. Yeah. And
A Christmas Prince, The Royal Wedding.
My big I've old watched suitcase. Christmas Prince.
But, you know, these are things that are made Princess now, Switch? And I don't think we need to...
Yeah, there's Vanessa Hudgens and Vanessa Hudgens.
Like, and her big old suitcase.
Cruising category.
But sometimes it doesn't need distance. So like something like Tom McLaughlin, who obviously directed Friday 13th Part 6, also directed She's Too Young, a Lifetime film about middle schoolers that get syphilis, with an incredible performance by, is it Marcia Gay Harden? Marcia Gay Harden. She is selling it. But there's no way for a moment that movie isn't full camp. Without the distance, but I love it.
Well, let's talk about The Perfection a little bit, because that's one that just came out that I've either heard people, like my mom watched it and was like, this was so extreme. This was crazy. Like she did not perceive it as campy in any capacity, whereas I'm watching it and as soon as they pull out the hatchet, I was like, oh my God, this is so fucking bonkers. I love it. Like it's a completely different take on it. So is that camp? And I mean, because it has just come out. Was it made with the camp? I love Sam's face.
I don't
right
know if
now.
It was made with the intent.
But that final form. I think that's a little campy, right?
It's a camp paper.
The like lesbian crab.
Final form.
You cannot put gold chains on those shoes and not be camp. That's an talk about an exaggerated.
I'm sorry,
pose.
You can't put a character with a wig on a wig and not be camp. She's got on a wig.
That's true. That's true. You're right.
Camp. Well, and that shades into like that really dotted line between camp and irony too.
We're like, you suck. Like, who did that? Which is it?
Or like in the I guess semi spoiler for the end of Murder on the Orient Express, it's 800 years old, so you're fine. But the new movie, when Michelle Pfeiffer takes off her brown wig to reveal she has blonde hair of the exact same length, it's like, wow, thrilling.
Is that what happens?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
I watched it.
Who taught everyone that? A drag queen.
Yes.
Exactly.
But, I think we're going too modern. I want to go back. I mean, like, we're talking horror. You know, what are some of your favorite camp classics? Like, what are those campy horror movies that you turn to time and time again that were identified immediately as, like, that's a campy movie?
Sleepaway Camp 2. That has to be one. Yeah. There's no way we watched...
Well, Sleepaway Camp 1.
I was just going to say the first one, the second one, the third one. Yeah.
But I especially think the second one because the first one had its low budget. And I think that there were moments where maybe they knew the whole time.
Yeah.
But Sleepaway Camp 2 was going into it with the intention that this is the thing we're making.
Yeah.
And I think it shows all the way through, which is why I think it's a great choice for our live show on Friday. Yeah. But
which one did you get to first? Was it the second one or did you see
it
in order?
The first.
I think the first is non-intentional camp. I think the second one is intentional camp.
Aunt Martha is camp.
Aunt right. Camp. Oh, she's something.
Like, wasn't that nice of me?
Didn't you come as Aunt Martha? Somebody came as Aunt Martha at Halloween for Halloween at Trivia. Somebody came dressed as Aunt Martha. I think it was Luke.
Did they have the string tied on her?
Yeah. It was a beautiful costume.
See, again, that's like a camp performance because what fucking movie is she in?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Where is she?
Oh, yeah.
She's like at a high school play.
Uh-huh. Like playing to the camera each and every set, like breaking the fourth wall.
But then again, like maybe there is intentional camp in that movie because like when the dads are like getting warm and light as opposed to hot and heavy, they
I was wondering where
they're like
was going.
In like a like static room that looks
it's all black and the kids and are like looking through the doorway.
Oh no, I think that was
what's that?
Like a twin size bed.
you don't have a sex void in your apartment.
Goals.
Sex goals.
The name of my
what really do you need for a sex void? Is it just black room
really
with a twin bed?
Yeah, nothing but a twin bed, baby.
I think in that case, I think they were trying to be artsy. To be honest,
right.
I think that they were in camp. You know, intending to go in with an artful eye and going, how can we handle this subject matter?
So in some instances, it's the further, and in other, it's the sex void. It just depends on how you look at the film. So.
Further is the sex void.
I want to know what the script said, like interior X.
Well, I mean, I look at Sleepaway interior Camp. Night. When we were talking about these, there were two titles that came to mind: Sleepaway Camp and Cheerleader Camp.
Ooh.
I mean, like those are pure camp. But I mean, like Return of the Living Dead is super campy and a lot of fun. And you know, I mean, like it's not a scary movie. It's there to humor, you know, and have fun and do send ups of tropes that we've known before.
So I'm going to take this moment to profess my love of Freddy's Dead, which I've done on the show before, and everybody makes the face that Sam's making right now, and then makes that noise right afterwards.
Really likes
Thank you, Ryan.
Find me a sex void stat.
So yeah. I love Freddy's Dead, but for me, it's camp, and it was made with a camp intention. And when you realize that the director, before she did Freddy's Dead, had done more campy sitcoms, it feels like exactly what she was meant to do. Like, you know, they knew what they were going in for, and the script itself feels campy for me. Like, it's so self-aware of everything that goes into a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. And so I've always explained why I love that movie through that. Like, oh, it's camp. It knows what it's doing, and it's doing it well. But everyone else hates it. So Freddy's Dead.
Well, I'm going to watch it now with that eye because I've never looked at it that way. But as soon as you said that, I immediately saw Tom and Roseanne Arnold.
Right?
And I'm like, oh, holy shit, they were doing camp.
Yeah, it's
like,
the whole thing.
They were on the number one show in TV at the time, and they were literally sending themselves up.
If you think about it in sense of like Motel Hell.
Yes.
And the same performances that you get out of the spouses in Motel Hell, out of Farmer Vincent, then suddenly it feels like a completely different movie than most people see it as. And that said, it does not fit in with any of the other Freddy movies. So I see why people don't like it, because the Freddy's movies had elements of camp, but it was all within Freddy's persona.
Absolutely.
I love that. But you feel like it's all within Freddy's persona, and the kids aren't in on it, and that persona is perceived as scary to them. But in Freddy's Dead, that camp extends through the entire film. Like the entire world becomes that same persona. So that's my Freddy's Dead
theory. I love that. I'm going to watch it now.
Yeah. Mic drop.
So, wow. No, but I was cheating on my test over here. And,
are you copying my work, right?
And I see that Becca's got Anaconda. On
yes.
I feel like Anaconda is the perfect example of a studio movie where they were going in with intentions of not being campy. Like I don't think for a minute that filmmaker was going, I'm making a movie, it's going to be super campy, and John Wink is going to wink at the camera once he gets spit out. Like, I genuinely think that there are filmmakers that go into these things with pure intentions. They got J-Lo, they've got tons of money at their fingertips, right? Ice Cube.
And it feels like a giant blockbuster film, but something just did not
Congo.
Come through. Congo's a great
Congo,
example.
Like, they were trying to make a summer blockbuster movie. But once I saw that, I was like, this fucking thing is campy as hell.
What about Lake Placid?
No.
No, I don't perceive that as camp.
I mean, that was Ally McBeal's, what's his face?
David E. Kelly.
David E. Kelly. No, I think he was just trying to do David E. Kelly doing a giant, a giant monster movie. And I think it worked really well.
I mean, it's a
fun movie. I don't think it's campy. Yeah, I think it's just a
fun
that
movie.
Is, that's just in his voice. That's like Ryan Murphy doing something.
Because right?
You just know what voice Ryan Murphy's bringing to the table.
Because if you think intention of the filmmaker, they could have gone completely different with a lot of the characters if they were doing intentional camp. Instead, Oliver Platt's character is played very benign. They could have done something completely different with, what's her name?
Bridget Fonda.
Golden Girls.
Betty White.
No. Betty White. They could have gone completely different, and instead she's just kind of the absent. No one in the film feels like they're larger than life or completely exaggerated. Like, she just feels like an absent-minded old woman.
I think she's super funny in that.
Well, yeah, she is. Yeah. She's hilarious, she's but yeah.
Well, I think it's like how you're going to ground the material. Like, you're doing a movie. What I think works so well about that movie is David E. Kelley is like, oh, I'm going to do a giant crocodile movie. Okay, let me ground the fuck out of this. Let's throw everybody's going to play it straight. Except for Betty White, you know, and Betty White's going to be larger than life. But in order for you to get into that movie, you're rolling with Bridget Fonda and all the, you know, Oliver Platt and stuff like that. Anaconda, on the other hand, I don't know. I mean, like, that's a terrible choice. Like everybody's playing it straight except for John Voight.
Yeah.
You know? Damn. I mean, you talk about chewing the scenery and being extra and, you know. I don't know. But Congo, I feel like, is super campy.
Mm-hmm.
Super campy. I mean, like, the fucking gorilla's got a martini glass.
I also wrote down My Soul to Take, which I've had arguments with people before over whether that was – oh, I don't like it.
Hey, Becca,
Becca. I don't like this movie.
Becca, Wes Craven's dead.
Ryan's jumping in.
I have to say Cursed, like 100% for me. Like Cursed is super campy. As soon as that werewolf throws up a middle finger and like Judy Greer's performance in that movie and Scott Baio being like weird Scott Baio, like – playing himself, but as a pervert, which is probably himself. But that movie is
That's a good example of camp coming out of a production situation.
Yeah,
because
they
had shot an entire. They shot that movie like twice over, and because it's such a like a patchwork quilt of badness, you know, that's like the camp came out of a shitty cut, you know, and someone going, hey, Judy Greer in a werewolf suit. She wasn't really in a werewolf suit. You know, flip off the camera, you know, I mean, like that is a very deliberate decision. It's very campy.
But is that the same thing that happened in My Soul to Take? Like, was there an intention going in that he knew what he was making?
I think he wanted to make a teen thriller.
Like, and then it just fell apart.
The thing about My Soul to Take is that I really do find it to be an authentic and raw piece from him. It does not succeed.
It doesn't succeed, but I completely agree with you. I think he intended he wanted to go in and tell something thrilling and another teen horror movie.
It incorporates some of his passions too. Like he loved bird watching, and there's that whole thing with the condor like vomiting.
It vomits on a table.
I don't think he talked to any teens before he made the movie, but he's trying.
Is The Nun camp?
The final scene of The Nun is camp.
Wait, right. The Nun movie? I don't know if I would consider that camp. And I'm a huge fan of Nun movies.
Me too.
I don't think that it was considered camp.
I was kind of just being a bitch.
Oh my gosh.
It's important to remember that just because something is camp, that doesn't mean that it's bad.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, in the case of Congo, correct. It's an awesome movie.
Happens.
Oh, man, it's fun.
It's a square rectangle thing. Like, a lot of bad things are camp, but not all camp things are bad.
Yeah.
Like, take a look at the Rocky Horror Picture Show. That's a masterpiece. And it's camp.
But I think that a lot of these would be.
I'm sorry. I know I'm a bad gay, but no.
What? No. No.
Okay.
You know what? If you don't think that that's campy, I think that means you're the most gay. No.
Wait a minute. Which one?
Like, Rocky Horror Picture Show.
I'm coming at it straight on the show.
No, I think
I would like to say, I think to look at the spectrum of camp, a great example would be the Child's Play series, especially in terms of intention and what you're talking about, Ryan, with grounding a film. Yeah. So on one end of the spectrum, we have Child's Play, the original, which is very grounded.
Yep.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have that. What was the last one? Cult of Chucky.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
My God. Oh. So if we're going through it and we have grounded on one end and intentional camp increasing as we move away from being grounded, to me, the peak of that is Seed of Chucky, which is intentionally campy.
Yes. Well, because
I personally love it.
Bride of Chucky was kind of like that bridge.
Yeah.
Yes. Where it was they were saying, there. Let's ground it with what's her face.
Yes. Jennifer Tilly.
Tiffany.
No, the blonde.
Catherine Heigl.
Catherine, thank you. Thank you.
Dream.
You always dream know when to bring person up Katherine Heigl.
So they ground it with that relationship with Katherine Heigl and her boyfriend. But, you know, the introduction of Tiffany was the introduction of, like, that full camp. Yes. Like, let's just bring it all in and embrace it. And then Seed.
And Seed, Chucky, lets it all hang.
Seed literally starts with the jizz.
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. on screen, like swimming journey around, right, going to an egg.
It knows exactly what it is.
Sperm journey into, yeah, sex boy. Yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like an E.E. Cummings poem.
No, and the fact that it even, like, leans so heavily on Ed Wood, mm-hmm, and it knows what it's doing from the get-go.
It's got John Waters in it.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's also a good way to look at the roadmap of how it goes too far, I think, when you look at the series as a whole. I think in some ways that's, well, and I know everybody has their different favorites. For me, that's where it peaked. Intentional camp succeeding, Seed of Chucky.
Mm. I'm into it. Always plant my flag for Seed of Chucky.
Well, and that's an instance of camp with time, where when I first saw that movie, I absolutely hated it. I actually remember turning it off, and it took, like, till, like, in the last year or two. It actually took till we watched it for the show for me, mm-hmm, to fully appreciate that movie and actually really love it. So, like, for Sam, it was intentional camp right away. But for me, it was, like, camp over time. So, you know what I mean?
Five times.
I think that's a really good example of where it's just, like,
that's campy.
Everybody showers differently, as Nay once said on a show. Different people shower differently.
I must have missed that episode.
Yeah,
that's
fine.
Yeah. Well, it's our episode on night school.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I got to listen to that now.
Camp.
All right. Yeah.
No, camp. It was our very first one. I don't know if
was
you
it? Oh, okay.
That was our test show.
Yeah, still finding your way.
Yeah.
Ninja 3.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that is
domination.
That is camp.
Yeah.
Like, there was, I think they went, I mean, I can't imagine for a minute the filmmaker and the producers went in and go, let's ground this and take this seriously. Like, I think that, I mean, like, that sex scene alone, you cannot take seriously. I think they went in with full camp, and it's like one of the greatest camp classics.
The V8?
The V8 sex scene, yeah.
A movie that's that slapdash in the sense of, like, we're going to make this in 2 weeks, and so mistakes are made. And that's camp, but that's not necessarily intentional in that kind of thing. Like, we're making a sequel. Here's $50. Like the Silent Night, Deadly Night 2 whole shebang. That movie is pure camp. And
it's like 45 minutes of it is the previous movie.
Yeah.
That's camp.
It, again, that, I don't know. That movie's,
you know what? Works. We were talking about, you know, things that didn't feel very authentic. Birdemic. Like, Birdemic was one of those movies that was made on, like, a shoestring budget. And they were like, look how campy we are. And I looked at it and I went, you know what? You're doing this for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm. Like, I just feel that one always just scuffed me.
Do you think that the filmmaker knew? Because he always claimed
he
didn't.
Of course he did. Of course he did.
He always claimed ignorance for the whole thing.
I just thought of a really fun modern camp movie that I actually just saw 2 weeks ago in the movie theater.
Oh, tell me.
Ma.
Oh, yeah.
And
again, important to note that camp doesn't mean it's a bad film.
I was in a theater. It was packed.
Yeah.
80% gay men. Time of my life. And I think a lot of it is when it comes to something being perceived as camp or playing as camp, I think being in an audience can play into that.
Well, I'm curious, like, what was
everyone,
what was everybody responding to? Was it just pure Octavia or was
her?
It, yeah.
The dialogue,
yep.
The situation, like, some of the deaths.
Alice,
like,
when Janie,
when
A+.
A character gets run over, the audience went insane. Anytime Missy Pyle is on screen, I mean, she literally starts with her head in someone's lap. And then, like,
and
gets
then
up.
And then tries to go back.
Yes. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's just, like, audience standing ovation.
Luke Evans is like, I'm good. I'm good.
Yeah. I mean, it was honestly, like, and I'm not just saying this because we're in Blumhouse's conference room. It was, like, one of the best times I've had at the theater this year.
Wow. Yeah.
And I think part of it is Octavia was having the time of her life making that movie, and it was very clear watching it. Yeah. But, like, audience does play a factor as well. And being in a movie theater with 80% other gay men.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You turn it into a camp film on your own.
Also, like, you know what? But I will say, sorry, Bruno, I don't mean to cut you off, but you reminded me of an experience in which I had that scenario. I was at The Exorcist Director's Cut, the version you've never seen, in 2000, and it played at the Man's Chinese Theater. And I felt like it was predominantly a gay audience.
They turned it into camp?
They kind of did.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think
and on one hand, and on one hand, I enjoyed it because I was like, okay, I'm seeing this in a new light. But on another hand, I was like, God damn it, guys, come
You're
on.
Disrespecting
can we just,
this.
Can we, just, yeah. can we just enjoy?
I don't think that was just your screening because I mentioned it a while ago on Killer POV that when I saw that in the theater as well, I saw it at the Lyric in Blacksburg where I went to college in 2000. And I remember everybody cracking up, like the spider walk sequence, every movement, the head turn, floating, guffaws from the audience.
I know so many people that say the first time they watch it, they thought it was hilarious. And I stomp my foot and go, because it like pisses me off so bad. But at the same time, like if that's how people are going to enjoy it in a theater, that's kind of fun.
And scenes of horror can really easily shade into camp depending on your investment in the material.
It's also a reaction.
So if you're approaching
it's
it
a
like
defense reaction,
like this is an old movie, I don't want to be scared by it, I'm going to laugh at it. Or like when people are uncomfortable, they tend to laugh. And horror is really easy at provoking those kind of reactions in people. Like in the movie Bloody Moon, the Jess Franco movie, child randomly gets run over by a truck. I'm sure that's made someone sad or horrified, but I thought it was hilarious. Because it depends on your investment in the material.
Was it even scripted, knowing just
probably.
I'm like, did this actor even know?
And the mom was like, hey, you can use my kid.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me of the opening night seeing American Psycho at the Burbank 16. And it was just me and a buddy and like just like a handful of people around us. But I immediately got the tone. I was like, okay, there's some camp qualities playing through. And when, you know, he picks
he's
up
dancing,
he
picks
dancing. Yeah. When he does like little shimmy.
Yeah.
And then when he picks up the kitten, he puts the kitten in the ATM and it's like, feed me a cat. And I was like, ah! And a person tapped me on the shoulder and was like, this isn't funny. I'm like, oh no, it's hilarious. This is fucking hilarious. Oh,
wow.
But yeah, it really, you know, the audience kind of helps guide you through all of that with the right people. Like me. Although, I'm thinking of the other one. What's that awful fucking witch movie with the dudes? The Covenant.
Oh, the Covenant.
That's awful fucking witch movie with the dudes.
Is it actually from the, Rennie Studio Harlan's Notes?
The Covenant? Is it The Covenant?
Yeah, with Sebastian
Stan.
When he says out loud, he's going to make you his weotch.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, girl.
Like that shit. It's the only movie where football player sized people are all on the swim team. It's like, get these guys in Speedos. Rennie Harlan knew what he was doing.
Rennie Harlan, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And
man.
Wasn't there like a whole string of sequels to that, too? Or am I confusing it with the
Taylor Kitsch and Sebastian Stan?
The Brotherhood. Yeah. Okay.
And Chase Crawford?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
And like, none of them are the lead.
But the reason why it's so easy to confuse Ryan the Brotherhood is they have those scenes with them in black boxer briefs. And, you know, all of those films just have a bunch of white guys in black boxer briefs or white boxer briefs, depending on which sequel.
The good guy was always in white boxer briefs and the bad guy was always in black.
Totally.
I know David Dakota films like the back of my
But here's the thing. Okay, we're all talking about this with love and affection, except when you're talking about Anaconda. But
or Congo.
I love Congo.
Listen, Amy holding her yellow drop drink or whatever. She's like, Amy, love drink. I'm like, yeah, you do. You drink that drink, Amy. You earned it. You earned that drink. We say these things with love and affection, whereas I'd say like the uninitiated to horror and the uninitiated to camp would not like they would like Absolutely. Watch they would watch it and go no not for me
it's true.
But we return to return to these things time and time again, no matter how bad they are. We enjoy them.
I remember that response right after Jason X came out where there was so many people just like, fuck this movie, it's terrible. And in the meantime I was like, no, this is so fun.
I mean, as soon as somebody says, have you seen so and so, and he's like, he's screwed. What movie do you think you're watching?
I know.
That
the head in liquid nitrogen, the kung fu fight at the end with the android.
Yeah.
I know. It's phenomenal. But that said, that's one that I perceived as they made it campy from the get-go. Like I don't think that there was ever a version of that script where they were like, let's take all this very seriously. Like it feels.
Well, that, according to Todd Farmer, who wrote it, said he wrote it to be like Alien.
This
and then
is true.
That came out.
Oh.
I wonder if the writer didn't, but
I feel like the filmmaker did.
No, he said he meant it to be scary like Alien. Like, that was the intent.
And I know the studio kept saying, make it more like Scream, make it more like Scream.
Yeah, kept rewriting it with those lines because of Scream. Yeah, exactly.
And like, you know, Scream was the only one that did Scream well.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So like, even Urban Legend, which I love, trying to replicate Scream. If you don't have the Kevin Williamson fingers type in your script, you turn into camp.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, Urban Legends camp.
Yeah, it is.
You know, like
Urban Legends final cut camp. Oh, my kind of camp. We've had this conversation, Ryan.
Yeah, I know.
But I would say when you talked about camp and needing to be versed in it, or maybe to the uninitiated, maybe somebody who loves horror or loves camp, but to everybody else, it's not. I do want to bring it back to identity, where I think that queer people in general are well versed in camp. I don't want to make a blanket statement, but I think that in our humor in general, culturally, we tend to keep each other. I don't know. I think that I could bring anybody, whether they like horror or not, to a campy film. And if we have a group of queers, like you had said at your screening of Ma, we're kind of here for it.
Yeah.
I don't know how you guys feel about it.
I mean, I feel like being queer is looking at what people think of as authentic and being like, that's not for me. That's not about me. That well isn't said. Me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. I think we're always outside of boxes. So get it.
Well, we use humor with each other a lot of the times too, because otherwise we'd spend most of the day crying together.
Some of us do that too.
Well, I think that's why it's important for people who are uninitiated with camp and the genre. It's like, see it with an audience.
Yeah.
Because you'll go for the ride.
And the communal aspect of camp and horror go hand in hand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So anyone initiated in horror but uninitiated in camp, seek out a camp film and see if you can find it like a screening somewhere or something.
Yeah.
What would you guys say? I have a question for the Shockwaves crew.
Yes.
If you could tell the audience to watch one camp movie right now, what would you tell them to watch? Loaded question.
Well, this is a test. I think it actually depends on the definition of camp and like how you're perceiving it at that time. Because I do have an answer, but first a sidebar. When I lived in New York, I lived in Chelsea for 10 years. So every single time I saw movies, I saw them in the theater in Chelsea, which is a predominantly queer neighborhood, which was honestly great because no one ever looked at me. I could walk out of the house with like mustard stains on my shirt and no one looked at me. It was wonderful. I remember
there's a group of gays talking about your mustard stains.
She thinks we don't see her.
Blowing up my
I felt so
right
invisible all, there, guys. It was wonderful.
They're
oh
all
gosh.
Wearing They Live sunglasses
but you
were,
watching. But Rebecca, it. You were safe.
Oh, I was. Oh, my safe. God. No, it was wonderful. And I had a building full of people who offered to walk my dog all the time. It was just phenomenal. I had my little dog. Still have Maggie. Anyways, so I remember seeing The Ruins in the theater in Chelsea. So I saw it there on opening night and everyone cracked up the entire way through. Like it was the campiest when the plants are singing the cell phone song.
I quit. that's some fucking bullshit. Right
there. So it was hilarious to everyone in the audience. And because I was in that crowd, I perceived that as a solid camp film.
Did you have a good time?
I had a fucking blast with it. Yeah. The girl freaking out because the plants are in her skin. Like everything was hilarious in this
fucking
particular
terrifying.
Audience. And then, okay. So
Ryan,
then
I
later,
actually had the same experience as you because I saw it alone at home.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't read as camp.
Shit's gnarly.
But so I love that.
But
it's just
the girl,
an evolved
like,
form of Vines, Becca.
I know. I know. Sorry. I had seen this and I was already working at Fangoria at the time. And then I went to work the next day and I was like, did we all see The Ruins? And started talking about how hilarious it was. And I remember Gingold being like, what movie did you see? That movie was fucking brutal. And I was like, no, it was great. The girl ripping the vines out of her skin. Get them out of me. Freaking out. So, completely different reads. So going in and recommending, I'm going to go with one. Let's see here. Which one would I recommend?
Becca, if you don't choose one that's on that list, like I know which one I would go for if I was Becca.
Well, see, my very first one would be The Apple, but it's not horror. So, but it's yes. one that I feel like everybody just needs to watch because it's just a blast. The one that I'm going to, well, Ticks.
Yes.
Ticks.
Yes.
Ticks.
Yes. Ticks.
I mean,
yes.
Yeah.
That is the Becca response. That's correct.
So, yeah.
No, because you talk about, I mean, like, I remember seeing it when it went straight to video back in the early 90s and I was like, oh my God. I mean, like, What does Clint Howard say?
Something. I'm infested, which was the secondary title of the movie.
That's right. That's right. And it's like, oh man, this is a camp classic.
His face is pulsating at the time. Yeah. And the fact that it is Clint Howard, like, I think that Tony Randall knew what he was doing. Totally, second time Tony totally. Randall's come up today.
Oh, yeah, you put Clint Howard in something.
Yeah, like, you just know what you're doing. And the fact that, I mean, the tick grows to epic proportions. I mean, and when you're doing that in the 50s, it was scary atomic war. But when you're doing it in the 90s, I mean, it's an anaconda thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But knowing what they're in, what they're up to, and riding that tonal balance, it was just perfect.
Yeah, I still think Tix is like a solid film. Like, don't go in it expecting it to be scary. But that said, it does have some really good effects. Like, the Tix do make you cringe. So
I'd probably go with Frankenhooker.
Ooh,
yeah,
good one,
Frankenhooker. Yeah, I mean, like, Henan Lotter's always striding like on that line and doing fucking wacky campy shit. But Frankenhooker, I mean, it's called Frankenhooker,
right?
You already know what you're
gonna. I love that the hookers literally explode like fireworks.
Absolutely. Yes.
Like, actually, it's not gory at all.
Pieces of body parts just flying everywhere.
And you hear like the sounds of fireworks.
Yes, right. Yeah.
From Supercrack or whatever.
Well, that was one of the things that, speaking of firework explosions, that was one of the things that I always thought was campy about John Carpenter's vampires was vampires is kind of like a Western horror movie with James Woods, you know, being a dick and fighting vampires. Yeah, I know. Exactly. Exactly. But the kind of campy thing that I was like, John, that's a bold choice to make, is when you drag the vampires out in sunlight, they went off like Roman sparklers.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And they were like, pew, 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 pew. And I was like, wait a second, what is this? And also, that was around the time when we had Blade. So when we saw Blade kill vampires, we saw Buffy kill vampires, they went up in like smoke and flames. Uh-huh. But he just made a bold, campy choice of just going, Roman candles.
Yeah.
Roman candles. And I love it for it. I love it for it. But yeah, maybe my choice is Frankenhooker. I mean, it's such a fun performance from the lead. She's great as the Frankenhooker herself. It's fantastic.
God. Well, so here's the thing. So my version of camp is like totally different, but I'll address this first since you guys have been looking at my computer and I have Gossip put up from 2000 with Norman Reedus.
Wait, what's it called? Gossip? God.
Remember Gossip?
Kate I haven't Hudson, seen this.
Norman Reedus. James Marsden.
It's like 2000 Deep Cut.
Oh yeah. And actually, I confused it with The In Crowd, which is what I looked
Same.
Up before
that. Yeah.
Was it Gossip or The In Crowd? Yeah. Isn't this the one where they just make up rumors Norman Reedus, he's like the son of one of the Rolling Stones. Uh-huh. That's the rumor. Yeah. So anyway.
Gets out of control.
Yes.
Oh, I'm so into this. It seems awesome.
Do you not remember this movie?
I don't think I've seen this one.
James Marsden, Pacey.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Oh,
epic time.
Wow.
So here's the thing with me. Like, I'm just a weirdo in general. So camp, the definition of camp to me is more like when every decision made on screen is wrong, like that no human being acts like that. So camp to me is those kind of movies. So something I watched recently over breakfast with my fiance, which we both held with laughter, was Scream for Help. Which is the Michael Winner movie written by Tom Holland.
So good.
Which literally there is not a single creative decision that is correct. No character acts normal. The score is all wrong. It just from moment one, you're like, what am I watching? Does this person understand human beings and how they talk? It's kind of like when an alien came down and was like, aliens are like, got it. We're going to make a movie now. So that to me is camp.
This is how humans talk.
Yeah. So that's my version of camp. But in terms of theatrical experience, the only one I had, and I don't know if this counts, I just remember it was like similar to the Exorcist experience that he was just talking about, which was when Van Sant's Psycho came out. Because Psycho is like my favorite movie of all time and I worship it. And then you go see that version of it and everyone was just laughing at everything.
Yeah. I mean, Vince Vaughn gives a pretty high camp performance.
Yeah. And you're like, no, the original is so good. Mm-hmm. You don't understand.
Yeah. I feel like that's a really good example of a movie where the actors were in a different movie than the director thought he was making. And I actually enjoy it for that reason. Cause like Julianne Moore, all of them are playing camp to me. And I feel like they are doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you got Gus Van Sant and he's like,
but he's still making a Van Sant movie.
This is an
movie.
Opus.
Yeah. He still has like the weird clouds rolling by.
Yeah. So like they got a different memo and they didn't tell their director. They're like, let's fuck with the substitute teacher today. But they did that on a whole movie shoot.
Well, I think the I actually did the commentary on the Scream Factory disc.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, because the editor of the movie is Amy Duddleton, who edited on Dexter. And that was literally the first thing they told me when I met her. Was like, by the way, she edited Psycho. And I was like, oh, I have so many questions. and she's pretty candid about it. Like, she knows everyone hates it. And she's like, I don't care. I had a great time. I got paid a lot of money.
Good
like,
for her.
Wonderful experience. I got to work with Van Sant. Yeah. But what she explained, which I thought was really fascinating, and it, basically his experiment failed, which is, can you remake a movie shot for shot and capture – just do it like a play or whatever? But what she was telling me as an editor is you can't edit a movie in 98 with the pacing of a 1960 movie.
Oh, that's a really good
point.
Yeah.
Like the shower scene, she's like, we cut it exactly as is, and it didn't work.
So dry as opposed to the original.
And so somebody cut a trailer, and the trailer had clouds and stuff in it. So like, just use the clouds from the trailer or something. Just something to break it up and make it feel faster. Wow. And I mean, that's the thing. It's like I know it's a very odd choice, but no, I always thought that was interesting. Is like even audiences' attention can kind of cause an unintentional camp.
Uh-huh.
Like they were trying to match something from 1960 that had a different audiences were used to that pacing of a movie,
right?
Mm-hmm. But in 1998, like you can't just give them the 1960 movie.
Yeah,
like and I mean it goes into like. Even the way horror has evolved, like there was the whole period in the early 2000s that was like super fast cut, like music videos or mm-hmm. the Saw thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Just a weird tangent there about
when I think it also kind of goes in line with like we were saying earlier about The Exorcist. A lot of people I know that have seen Psycho late in life or well after a lot of other people, they think it's funny the first time they see that mm-hmm. too, where I'm like, girl, did we watch the same movie? You know?
So, I've heard the same about Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where people who see it later in life will perceive it as slightly campy.
Tested my boyfriend, had him watch it. In my head, I was like, if you don't react the way I want you to, we're done. He thought it was amazing and terrifying. So I was like, okay, we're good.
Sergio, he's my
favorite. Actually really didn't do that.
My boyfriend, that was one of the first movies that I showed to him. And he was like, why are all these idiots just walking into the same house? They're so stupid. And I'm like, you don't get it. Never mind.
Look at the fucking chicken bones on the floor. Are you not scared right
now? There's chicken bones.
I wanted to say one of my favorite specific elements that I find campy is when a veteran actress lends her talents to a movie with a bunch of more unknown people. Mm-hmm. The 2017 Leatherface, Lily Taylor is in it. Her performance is exquisite. There's a part where potentially her son Leatherface has escaped from the mental institution and she slaps the shit out of this orderly just out of nowhere, and that is camp. And since we talked about Mom, we kind of opened the door of the Blumhouse. I did want to mention Juliette Lewis and Gemma and the Holograms, because I think that is a perfect, perfect villain performance. It is to the rafters. She walks like Ursula from Little Mermaid, and I'm just spooning it in. It's so good. I don't know. I'm not being ironic about Gem and the Holograms. I love that movie.
I enjoyed it as well. And my daughter really liked it too. So yeah.
Ugh, you're lucky. I literally want to die and be reincarnated as one of your kids. Yes. Like coolest mom ever.
You're welcome to come join us anytime. You are now officially adopted.
I'm like, dye my hair.
I totally will.
That is amazing.
For the listeners at home, I let my 6-year-old dye her hair blue. So yeah.
It looks great.
It does.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Seriously, so cool.
So yeah. Well, side tangent.
I was going to say, we finally let ours dye her hair legit.
This washes out, but I told her she could keep doing it, but it washes out in 2 weeks. That's so cool. Yeah, but she has a lot left. So she's like, I'm doing it all summer.
Did you guys list all your favorite camp movies? I know you asked us. Is there one specific one that we should all seek out, audience and
shoppers? I had one literally 5 minutes ago and I'm blanking now.
Sam.
Someone else go first.
Don't worry, we'll just wait.
I mean, I could do a non-horror movie one in 2 seconds if you guys want that.
Go
in the meantime,
for it.
Grease 2. Watch it.
Oh my God. I can sing every every song with you.
Yes. Oh,
holy shit!
What?
Why
we'll be together? Which one?
Huh?
What's it called?
Grease 2.
Oh, Grease 2. I thought you said Priest 2.
Oh, no, Grease 2.
Grease
I was like, there's a Priest 2.
They made a Priest 2 and it's a musical? So,
BJ Colangelo. Did I say your last name right?
I've tried this.
Colangelo. Yeah. We have expressed so much love on Grease 2, which I consider better than Grease 1. Mm. Grease 1 bores the shit out of me. Grease 2.
Listen, you guys start your musical podcast.
Okay.
Let's go
there.
Down the line.
We'll talk about this later. We're in.
Sam, do you have a horror?
Sam, what
do you
got? Well, so non-horror, just to say it, Josie and the Pussycats, Intentional Camp.
So good. Love it.
Incredible film, great soundtrack. Moving on, Death Spa. Feed me asparagus, put bandages over my eyes.
You say feed you asparagus?
Yeah, Death Spa, he feeds his girlfriend asparagus after she's like nursing her blindness.
Alternate
I'm
title.
I'm going to know when you pee. Okay.
Alternate title.
Like, that's why you're eating that.
I love Death Spa. Yeah,
the alternate title of Death Spa is Witch Bitch. That is a camp
movie. Is it really?
It's incredible. Yeah. It's a movie that doesn't know, is it a computer virus? Is it a witch? Is it, I mean, the killer?
Yes, the answer is yes.
And it's all of it, guys. How do you not love that?
It does have the greatest bro hand clap of all time.
Okay, I need to rewatch Death Spa.
It's so special.
I remember when that movie, it was doing its Blu-ray release or its DVD, like a big release.
We showed it at a Jump Cut Cafe. Yeah.
And I missed it that night because I had just given birth. And
a valid excuse.
I know. I wasn't at the Death Spa screening. And so then Elric passed me the copy of it and was like, watch it at home so we could discuss it on Killer POV. I was so goddamn bored.
I need to rewatch. That was very special.
Sorry, this slipped my mind and I don't know how. Timmy and the T-Rex. If we're talking about queer representation, and I just want to say, because there is a queer black character in 1994?
Well, we saw Tammy and the T-Rex a couple of weeks ago. Elric and I went to the AGFA screening that they did at the Egyptian.
The R-rated cut?
So fun. R-rated cut was amazing. But so I'm watching it and I'm going, jealous. Wait a sec, there is this queer black character in the 90s. And I was like, I've only seen this one other time and it was in Mannequin. And then I looked and it's the same director from Mannequin 2.
No way.
And then suddenly you're like, oh my God, this kind of makes sense now.
That moment when the T-Rex is deciding what body to go into and they suggest a female body and he considers it for a second, queer.
Yeah.
Incredible.
I love it. Nate. No, that movie across the board is total camp and was clearly planned that way because when you realize the other films that the director had done, like Mannequin 2, they all feel. He also did Mac and Me. And then suddenly you're like, okay, he knows what
my
he's
cat's
doing.
Favorite movie, by the way. She cannot take her eyes off it anytime it's on the screen. That and Planet Earth.
Do you have a title you want to read?
Man, we've been having such a good time, and I'm like, I feel like if I bring up this movie,
okay,
do it.
I'll lose all my friends, like I do when I bring up this movie. But in terms of the most exaggerated pose I can think of, it's like the Human Centipede.
Oh my god!
I love it so much,
so
and I make people
what you're
watch
say,
it.
But no,
I was like,
right.
Is she going to say like something like a serious horror film?
No.
Doesn't he say at the very beginning when he's looking at his photos of his animals and he's like, "My beloved three dog" or something like that? Like once you get you know what the funny thing is when I had seen. When I saw a screener of that at my house, it had already come with there was so much preamble of like, oh man, this is going to be a mind blower. This one's going to make you, you know, hurl chunks and oh, it's crazy. And I was like, oh fuck, what the fuck am I going to get into? Am I getting into Hannibal Holocaust? And then 5 minutes in when he's like, my beloved three dog, I'm like, oh, all right. I know what I see through you. I know the tone of this movie. I can handle it. I'm good to go. Let's go.
No. And I think that they definitely knew with the first one what they were doing. I mean, the actual like mad doctor, he's like the doctor from Maniac Mansion. Did anybody used to play that video game?
Yeah.
He's just so over the top and campy. And that for me was what the second one lost. Cause the second one, whereas the first one had this vein of camp and it wasn't riding that, like it was definitely trying to push something. But it knew it was there. The second one just became cruel and was just cruel and kind of ugly. And I know people who still love that one, but for me, it definitely went. It went from like a 1970s, like Doris Wishman, John Waters, like shock movie of like, you're never going to believe what we're going to show you, to a torture porn.
Yeah.
And so it veered in a completely different direction in that.
I just like both.
Okay, so you're one who likes the second one.
Yes. It's disgusting.
Can I rattle off just a really quick couple titles before I do my like main course?
Of course.
Sure. How unlike you.
Welcome to Thursday.
The chef is bringing some appetizers.
Just teasing, Brennan. We love you.
Sorry, I love movies, everyone. I just want to hit you with Phantom of the Mall, Eric's Revenge.
Yep.
Morgan Fairchild is in it. Morgan Fairchild is camp.
Yeah.
American Gothic from 1988.
So fun.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Pieces. Oh, my Bastards. God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you, you've got yours.
You know what? I take it back. Thank you for reminding me about Pieces. I don't know why that was like way back in my brain. Forget Frankenhooker. Pieces. That's what I would expose.
And that falls into my camp category where I don't know any human that acts like anybody in Pieces.
Yeah.
If given the choice, I would expose the world to Pieces.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go on.
Then Slumber Party Massacre 2, yep. Obviously.
That's a good one.
And then the movie that I actually showed Ryan Larson this morning, 1986's Killer Party.
Yes,
Killer Party. Is that the one with the organized dance scene where they do the synchronized dance sequence?
I think you're thinking of Strange Behavior.
I am thinking of Strange Behavior. Thank you.
But it does open with a movie that becomes a music video.
Oh,
that becomes the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. like, everyone in it might as well be just dressed in one giant leg warmer. It's truly out of control. And I will never spoil the last 15 minutes for anybody who hasn't seen this movie, but it's incredibly special. It's such a good movie.
I'm going to watch it, Brennan.
Yeah. And also, it is a slasher movie that forgets it's a slasher movie for about 50 minutes and goes, oh, shit, throw in a deep sea diver to kill a bunch of people. Just rapid fire, 30-second scene, slam them all together. Now we're a slasher.
Wow.
It's so good.
I need to rewatch this because I am definitely confusing it with Strange Behavior in my head.
Strange Behavior is also very
good. Yeah, it's very good and very campy. And it does have a synchronized dance sequence midway through. But I'm merging the two in my brain. So I really need to rewatch Killer Party.
Please. Something I love about Killer Party is that for something that jumps the shark like over and over again, it is incredibly cohesive. By the end of it, you're like, oh, yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Deep sea diver. Okay.
And Paul Bartel is in it. Yeah. The guy who directed Private Parts, among other things that are more famous. Eating Raoul. Anyway.
So I remembered mine. Texas Chainsaw 2.
Nice. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Must watch. Yeah. And Do you need to see the first one?
I don't think so because it feels so different. And they reevaluate the family's roles in the second one. Like everything gets shifted.
They also bring up to speed in the opening crawl.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, that is true. It does have a Star Wars-esque crawl.
So that was the one I was thinking of.
Nice.
My
friends.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on.
Yes.
Thanks for having
Thank
us.
Thank you.
So
that was an enlightening and fun conversation. Rob, did you have fun?
I had a lot of fun. I'm just really tired.
Becca, did you have fun?
Real. Oh, my God, yeah. I got to talk about Grease, too. Even if only for 10 seconds, we slipped that in there, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where does a pollen go?
Oh
God! Talking to the Queer Wolf Thursdays, Shockwaves Fridays,
double dose every week.
Tune into both. Who are some of your upcoming guests?
Can we reveal? We have coming up. I'm blanking. Well, help me!
I don't really want to say just in case, because you know sometimes
now is the time to plug.
What?
Now is the time to plug an upcoming episode. I was just saying.
Okay,
give it away.
Theoretically, we may or may not be talking to Joshua Conkle, who's the head writer of The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he's supposed to come in.
Yeah.
Theoretically,
Chelsea Stardust.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah,
bad bitch. Love her.
She is a bad bitch.
She qualifies.
And
Cooper
Samuelson from Blumhouse will be on the show.
This
is your first straight dude.
I think he is.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm completely offended that I was never brought on. And
also, allegedly, Chris Peckover, who directed.
Oh, Chris is great.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Love Chris. Yeah.
Nice.
Well, thank you all for coming on.
Thank you guys so much.
Listeners, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Woohoo.